Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lethal Manga Recap here on special Sunday afternoon time, January 24th, 2016. Nick screwed up last week, so I'm sorry.
I thought we were doing this because we thought the only way to really test Weekly Manga Recap success was to pit it up against NFL Championship Sunday and see how we fare in comparison.
I don't think we're going to do incredibly well.
Are you sure?
You know, maybe if we, like, do a scale of, like, one Weekly Manga Recap viewer is equivalent to, like, a million NFL viewers.
Holy shit, we're doing great then!
Oh my god, we're winning!
We're crushing The Walking Dead, Nick! Finally!
Each of you guys is worth a million views. Aww.
Yeah, there you go.
So here is what happened. I work a night shift now as part of my other job, I guess you could say. And it's not always the night shift, though. Sometimes I have to do the afternoon shift, and so my sleep schedule has to go back and forth. And that's not good for you. And in fact, I'm probably not going to be doing both shifts from now on. I'm going to just be doing one, hopefully. And so what happened was I went to bed after a night shift at like 9:30 in the morning, and then I did not wake up until 11 at night. Like, I slept for literally over 12 hours. And so Chris was like, "Where's Nick?" Next. "You gotta be able to do Weekly Manga Recap, dude? What the fuck? Why is it dark yet?" Ah!
You saw a text like 6 hours later, like, "Huh, what's up with that?" "Yeah, I'm definitely gonna be around for Weekly Manga Recap later."
"Why is it so dark outside?"
"Where is my day gone?"
So, I apologize for that. I will try my hardest to not let it happen again. Because, I mean, I'm not happy about it. I know that you guys, you know, went without Weekly Manga Recap, but also that threw, I had to like reschedule a whole bunch of stuff so that I could do it today instead. And, you know, I was very upset on Wednesday because, like, I can't believe I slept until fucking 11 at night. So that's not going to happen again. But in the meantime, we have brighter things to discuss in order to keep the other folks who are on the East Coast warm. Because how much snow have you gotten, by the way, Chris?
3 feet worth.
Jesus Christ!
Yeah.
Snow gets that high?
Yeah, if I walked outside right now, it's essentially like, I feel like I'm in World War I, like I'm in the trenches. Like, if I dove down, I'd be completely buried by snow at that point. And I can't really, like, I can't, like, turn my camera, you won't have the perspective to see it, but the snow outside my back window over here is literally halfway up our fences, and we have tall fences here. We couldn't let Scotia out to actually go to the bathroom anywhere because the snow's too high. So we had this little area underneath our deck that hadn't gotten snowed in. We were like, just let her go out there, you know, let her do her business there, whatever, we'll clean it up later. She gets out there, but she really wanted to get out into the lawn. So she just tries to force herself through the snow, like dive bombing into it.
Just goes, covered.
Dive, like she gets covered in snow. It's not just like slamming her head, she just hurls herself into the snow. And, like, 3 times, like, it's like, "Oh, this is cold, this sucks!" And then goes back in the house. Keeps trying it, though. I really applaud her dedication. No, not a smart head on this dog. I'm never going to call her a smart girl, but a lot of heart in her.
Yeah. We may love pets, but dogs and cats aren't the smartest at, and not the best at learning through experience.
They're not brilliant.
Oh, God. No, just, like, nothing on the news, but like, it's cold up in the north. It's like, I live in Florida. It was in the high 40s today. Ooh.
It was frigid. Ooh. Yeah, no, I'm pretty furious in that regard. It's uncomfortably cold. I'm wearing my running tights just as, you know, underneath pants because it's just otherwise, why bother?
Use them like thermal underwear or something.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, I think that we have a series recommendation we're talking about this week that should hopefully get people's blood boiling.
Well, we'll be fired up with energy, with heat, with burning passion, Nick.
With stance, I mean waves.
Hamen. Hamen waves.
Right. That comes later. Okay. But, yeah, and Yeah, so the series that we're talking about is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, although specifically we're talking about just the first part of it, which is Phantom Blood, so that we can kind of pace ourselves and get Nick slowly acclimated to this weird series that Chris loves so much that has gone on for longer than we've been alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Phantom Blood, which focuses on...
Jonathan Joestar.
I was about to say Joseph, and I was like, that's not right. He was the guy at the end of the fifth volume that I read a little bit into. So, Jonathan Joestar. His kind of brother, but mostly just arch-nemesis, Dio Brando, who would go on to become much more famous than the eponymous first JoJo, actually. So, basically, how do we begin? I guess I'll explain how I understand the series now that I've read it, because I'm going to be speaking much less familiarly about it. So, the Joestar family is this wealthy family in England, which, oh yeah, I remember that Joestar, that English Joestar dynasty.
In the old 1800s.
The series has weird names, so I'm going to try not to get caught up on it.
Well, here's the thing.
Half of the characters have rock band references.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to refer to characters as names that aren't completely accurate to the English volumes that I read, because I'm used to this series back when I read it through Scanlations and things like that before it got officially translated. And I think with the official translation is that a lot of characters are directly named after rock bands,
right.
And they couldn't, for a lot of them, legally call them that, because a lot of band names are actually trademarked. So they had to change them slightly. So, like, there's a master out there, like Master Tom Petty, I think they call him in this. I'm going to call him Master Tom Petty, because that's how I know him as. But just understand, I got the English volumes, and it was weird for me. I'm like, this guy's name is Tom Petty. Why are they calling him Tom Petty?
So, anyway, the Joestar family is this wealthy family, but one day, the husband and wife, the head of the family, Jonathan's parents, while he's just a little kid, they die in this, like, accident while they're traveling. I think, like, their car goes over a cliff or something like that. Is it in the, like, 1880s?
The late 18th century, or late 19th century, I guess it would be, but yeah. Right.
And so they come across by this this random lowlife thief. I forget who Dario Brando, I think.
Something like that.
Dio Brando's father. And so he's just like, oh sweet, a wealthy family who's, you know, they're all dead. He's taken everything. But Jonathan Joestar, it turns out, has actually survived. And he is mistaking Dario as actually trying to help him. And so he's like, oh, yes, I will repay you. Actually, it looks like a random thief has stolen all my stuff, but thank you.
Yeah, it looks like someone got all my stuff first.
Dario's like, yeah, I saw him. Yeah, he was an asshole, yeah.
Super hot, though. That's the one thing I remember about him. Extremely
ruggedly handsome in a strange way, yeah. So, basically, Jonathan Joestar is like, oh, yes, I owe you, you know, a life debt. If you ever need help, then I, you know, I will help you. So, like, 15 or 18 or something like that years go by, Dario dies, and his son, Dio, goes to live with the Joestar family because Jonathan feels that he owes the Brandos a life debt, so he'll raise him as his own son. And so, Dio and Jonathan basically spend their teenage years living together, and from the get-go, Dio is being just this complete dick to Jonathan. Like, he is...
He hates the shit out of him from the moment he sees him.
Hates him. Because it's weird because, like, his plan clearly is to just, you know, take over the Joestar household, and so he is trying to basically destroy Jonathan so that he'll be the sole heir once his father dies. Apparently he also just hates his guts. And honestly, teenage Jonathan is kind of a pansy, so...
he's an absurdly good human being, but he does not have Like, he spends a lot of time playing around with the dog and, like, chasing after one girl.
You're
and,
my
like,
best beating, friend, though, buddy.
Yeah, and, like, beating up bullies, but, like, getting his ass kicked.
I shall fight you, sir.
Yeah, it's very...
Stop harassing that young lady.
His whole thing is he's supposed to be, like, a gentleman. Like, that's, like, it's the gentleman way, and that's the logic he works under for a lot of his things. So he's like, I'm not doing it because you're a woman. I'm doing it because a gentleman would never allow someone to be hurt in a fight like this.
This guy is drastically missing a handlebar mustache. I can't believe he never gets one.
It might have been too much.
Especially because Tom Petty has one later on. And,
Zeppeli, you mean?
Yeah. I'm getting Zeppeli, Zeppelin and Tom Petty. Because they're both monks.
One of them's a fabulous monk.
Right. But basically, eventually, Jonathan, over the years, grows into, like, an actual badass gentleman. Mm-hmm. He still has basically a lot of the same traits that he had as a teenager, but he can actually, you know, fight the bullies that he tries to stand up to, and he's a lot wiser in the way that things work. And so, essentially, the series focuses on this tremendous blood feud that unfolds between Jonathan and Dio as the resentment that exists between them becomes extroverted, as opposed to, you know, secretive and, you know, sabotage-y, and, you know, suspicion of said attempts to sabotage. But then it turns out that Dio becomes a vampire, and the series comes completely different for, like, the last 60% of it.
Essentially, this is a three-volume story. If you go by the English release, it's a three-volume story, and the entire first volume, so the first third of the story, is basically just the origin story of Dio and Jonathan, because the first volume doesn't end... It basically ends with the mansion on fire and Dio and Joseph about to, like, or Jonathan about to kind of square off. And you're like, holy shit, like, there's two more volumes of this. And I don't remember much plot going on in between there. And I'm like, oh yeah, the rest of it's kind of just fights that pop up. But that first volume, when you think in terms of pacing, is just them kind of getting to that point. Which, in one hand, works kind of in an interesting way, because it does build up this relationship between them. Somewhat of a weird way, but you do get their strife between them, especially because Dio is cartoonishly evil.
Dio,
like,
is
magnificently evil at
Dio
points.
Dio is amazing. And, I mean, I've heard that he gets better. I understand that he gets better, but he was easily the highlight of this series. From when he first shows up and he's just, you know, scheming about all this random stuff. Like, in order to prove himself to be better than Jonathan, like, he tries to basically cut Jonathan off from all of his friends. And so, you know, it basically has this complete plan to just completely destroy Jonathan, and he's like, okay, I'm going to make sure that his father doesn't believe in him and he sees me as being better. I'm going to make sure that his girlfriend can't stand the sight of him, and so he has no support from her. I'm going to make sure his friends don't like him and they like me better, so he has no support from them. So to do this, he joins this little boxing match. This random rich people only boxing match. And he is a better fighter than Jonathan, so he whips his ass. He just completely schools him, makes a fool of him. But just because when he lands the decisive blow to Jonathan, he also makes sure to extend his thumb out so that he can try to gouge his eye out.
He's such
just
a shit.
Because.
He's such a dickhead. Like, cartoonishly so, which makes him so entertaining. Like, Jonathan has a dog, Danny the dog, and I knew what happened already because I had read the series before, but now
I know what's gonna happen to him.
Yeah, now I have Scotia, and Scotia actually looks a lot like Danny, and it's so heartbreaking to see it, because he doesn't just kill this guy's dog, he like kidnaps the dog, wires the dog's mouth shut, puts it in like a trunk, puts that into the incinerator. And you're like, oh my god, the dog gets burned alive. Like, well, no, that's not exactly all that happens. The dog escapes and runs out on fire to burn to death in front of the whole family. And you're like, Jesus Christ. You didn't just take away this dude's one friend. You set it on fire in front of him.
Well, not in front of him. They explicitly say that they made sure to bury the body before Jonathan's.
Yeah, but it's still just like, oh my god, this is... so ridiculous. And he has no regrets to it. He's unbelievably heartless. There's a quote that I love. It's it may be my favorite part of this whole first part entirely, where Zappelli, like, has a confrontation with him, and he's like, how can you do this, Dio? How can you kill so many people? And Dio just responds with, like, that fucking, like, but for me it was Tuesday line. He's like, do you care about how many, do you remember every piece of bread you've eaten in your life? I didn't think so. And you're just like, what the fuck? What a shit you are, Dio.
So, it's interesting to see this because, yeah, I mean, the first part is really weird because you start off like, wow, Dio is so super cartoonishly entertaining and Jonathan's just this wuss. Why do I care about Jonathan? But then we get a little bit of time skip to basically when they're at the end of their college years. And we haven't really seen Jonathan develop very much, unfortunately. He just kind of has by the end of that time. And by the time that he is a much more, you know, likable character. He basically has gone from being this muscular yet somehow wussy gentleman to being Kenichi. You know, he cries manly tears and he's got the badass, you know, stern face and stuff and all that. And, you know, so honestly, like, by the end of that first part of the story where essentially they have their big initial confrontation, and it looks like Dio's been killed the first time. It looks like he's been killed, like, five different times or something in this series, and he keeps on coming back. It seemed like it was going to just be this very nice, contained story of, you know, setting up the rivalry between them, building on it, and then eventually Dio is like, you know, tries to make his move and assassinate Jonathan's father. Jonathan finds out about it because he finds that Dio's been taking his father's medication, and he's like, what the hell are you adding to that? And then he gets it examined, and it turns out, of course, it's poison. So he goes to try and find the cure for the poison that his father's been slowly being given. And, meanwhile, this mask that is within the Joestar Mansion turns out it's cursed, and somehow it makes vampires.
Obviously.
They explain that it has to do with... They explain that it reacts to blood, and then when blood hits the mask, these spikes go, you know, into whoever's wearing it. And so... Dio, of course, at first thinks, oh, I can use this as, like, my perfect assassination plan. You know, I'll make it seem as if, you know, Jonathan was just... Because, you know, Jonathan's been researching the mask, and Dio finds his research notes and stuff. He's like, what if I, you know, just make it look like Jonathan was just, you know, researching this, and then in the midst of his research, he accidentally triggered it while he was trying to figure out what it did, and then it kills him. But then he's like, ah, but yes, I see that these spikes that go into the brain, yes... they actually cause secret hidden parts of human nature contained within the brain to be triggered. So, somehow this makes him into a vampire.
I'm going to tell you right now, Nick, knowing what happens in the future with JoJo's Adventure, you just have to accept that the science of this, it works in this universe. Because when you get to fucking part 7 and everything revolves around the golden ratio, you can't question. You just have to be like, yeah, sure, the golden ratio is responsible for creating wormholes and shit. Why not? But that's kind of the fun of JoJo, is, like, it is just a silly series, and it uses this logic to kind of ground everything to explain it in the universe, but it's not completely serious. Like, there's points that just, you pan to something, you're me like, oh my god, this is ridiculous. Like, there's more than one shot of Dio Brando hanging upside down from a surface via his fingertips. And every time you see it, you're just like, what the fuck is happening? And he just uses it to, like, tear motherfuckers' heads off. Like, he's just like, you here have a head, I want it, yoink, and just rips it off. And, like, anytime you see that happen, I can't help but laugh, because it's so ridiculous and preposterous. Dio Brando, like, straight-faced and as stoic and evil as he is, just hanging upside down by his fingernails with the rest of his body completely straight. Like, it's just so gloriously silly.
I guess, I mean, yeah, it deserves mention that the artwork in JoJo is unique. Not just in terms of how, like, characters are designed and, you know, very square-chinned, bulging muscle men, but also you know, the JoJo pose is kind of infamous in terms of how weird it is. They just in the myth, not just like they'll strike a pose to be badass, they'll just kind of naturally end up in a very bizarre pose while they're in the midst of fighting or walking or talking or all sorts
of like, it's time to hit you with my Harmon Yellow Light! And you're just like, how did you get into this pose? But then he's going to break your chest open from that pose. You're like, all right, fair enough. All
right. If it works, it works.
Yeah.
So, I guess, let's see. So what happens is...
Dio is buried alive, and everyone assumes right. that's the end of him. And
it's actually a really badass fight, too, because this is before JoJo actually develops the signature technique within this part of the story. He just, you know, fights Dio, and he's, you know, he's just got his own natural physical strength, and what they actually tie it down to is the fact that they fight within the mansion as it's burning down around them, and JoJo just... Because he's so familiar with the way the mansion is set up, he knows that he can drive Dio through a particular wall and, like, spear him on a statue. He just knows it's going to be there, and so that's why he manages to defeat him. But Dio survives because vampires can't be killed, basically.
Yeah, vampires are super immortal, but, like, the plot becomes after that. Like, he meets Zappelli. I forget. Arthur Zappelli, I think, is his name. I can't remember his first name.
Because yeah.
The Zappellis are a thing in JoJo series that they reoccur as time goes on. So he meets Zappelli, and Zappelli is the one who basically teaches him about Harmon.
Wait, before, we have to mention first, Chris, that when he finds out about the poison, he meets his loyal friend, a street thug named Speedwagon, who becomes essential to everything that happens in the series.
He is so weird in that he does nothing.
He is the Chad of JoJo. He shows up and he's a loyal companion to JoJo, and he swears to be by him after, you know, after Jonathan defeats him in a fight, and he's like, okay, yeah, you know, you're a good stand-up guy. I will help you, and you know, I'll show you the information you need. And then he just kind of hangs out with JoJo for the rest of the series.
And it's great because he, like, every so often he just sits there and, like, he gets really upset with the fact that he can't do anything to help. Like, he's just like... I really wish I could help JoJo in this moment, but I can't do anything.
I can't master the technique that allows, you know, JoJo to fight with vampires. Zappelli, is there a way that I can learn the technique to help me fight vampires? And Zappelli's like, no.
Well, then Zappelli's like, maybe. I just have to I have to fuck with your throat a little bit. Boom! I messed up. You're just gonna suffocate a little bit.
Sorry about that. Go throw your weird odd job hats at people.
And also, that is where we meet the casual racist character of fucking part one. The character who, for the 90% of this series, is only referred to as the Chinese guy. Until the very end, they're like, oh no, he has a name. It's Wang Chung. You're like, why didn't you just call him that then? Why is for 90% of the series? Because he's so, like, stereotypical. Giant fucking eyebrows that go out to here. And, like, I feel like he has buck teeth, too. Like, it's like, oh, this
it's
is
so
such a...
weird because this is written by a Japanese artist. Well, turns out Japanese people can be racist towards Chinese people.
Yeah, they didn't like Chinese guys. There's a lot of small characters you meet like that, but the most notable character that he meets then is Zappelli, who becomes his teacher and teaches him Harmon, which is basically a breathing energy that you can then translate into other living things, and it gathers its power via sunlight. So it's ability that basically can be used to transfer sunlight into other things. And thus, by that way, it is the perfect way to fight vampires, because their only weakness is sunlight, but if they stay indoors or they fight in darkness, you can't do anything to hurt them then. But Harmon can prevent that, basically.
They just regenerate from whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, more than half of the series after that point is just JoJo and his friends trying to track down Dio so that they can kill him, and then the threat that he poses to the rest of the world, because Dio... basically is to say, well, I guess, you know, I'm a vampire, and everyone knows I'm a vampire now, so, well, the Joestar Mansion's been destroyed, so fuck all that noise. All
right,
I'm gonna go start up my own kingdom, then. I'm just gonna go to Transylvania or something like that.
I'll just find every fucked up serial killer along the way and make them part of my army.
Hijack the river!
I'm gonna shove a bunch of scalpels into you and You'll bolt some out whenever you flex. You're gonna hide in a horse.
Don't ask me how that works.
So, like, I love that, because at one point they pop out and they're like, why is the horse stuck? And fucking Jack the Ripper explodes everything. Like, he's been in the horse the whole time. Like, has he been inside the horse for 9 hours and has been fucking carrying us here?
It's like, you know, the most gruesome equivalent of, yeah, having two guys in a horse costume. Okay. So, yeah, Dio goes around and he's zombifying people and they're terrorizing townsfolk. He does, like, very stereotypical Dracula in his castle, bring in maidens in order to subsist off of the young women's energy and stuff like that. And then I think my favorite ridiculously evil moment of his, at one point, like, there's, like, a young mother with her baby, and she says, please, you can kill me, but don't harm my baby. And he says, I, this Dio Brando, promise that no harm shall come to your child from either myself or my men. And he zombifies her, and she eats her baby.
Yeah, she immediately devours her child, and he's like, ho, 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 ho.
I said it would not be my men or me.
It's like his one restrained step away from, like, falling back on his legs, kicking into the air, giggling, like, ho, 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 ho. I got her.
Exact wording.
He's such a shit.
He's such an ass. But it turns out that Dio has this amazing trump card ability that only he has, none of the other zombie vampire henchmen of his have it, which is he can just project horrible cold from his body. And so the energy of the sun can't reach him, because basically the power of breath is translated into movement, and so he just basically, the way that Hama works is if you breathe in, you can translate your breath into waves through your blood, and then that travels out of your body through your blood into other things. So he just freezes people's limbs, and thus things can't travel through their blood. So people try to punch him, and he's just like, froze your arm.
Well, yeah. Shit.
So, yeah, he's pretty badass, basically.
He is. And, essentially, the break afterwards is, you know, Jojo learns about Haman. You know, that kind of training takes place a little bit off-screen, and then it's, like, the quest to stop him. And as they go on, they find Jack the Ripper, they fight him, and then they fight against Dio's, like, subordinates, which are, like, two knights that I don't know if these guys are real or not. I never looked into it. I assume they have
They seem to portray... This series has a weird understanding of British history. I think that they portray the current monarchy as the evil one. Because they say there was the War of the Roses and two knights loyal to the wonderful and beautiful Mary Tudor. Wait a minute, they were the ones who lost, though. Didn't she imprison her sister in a castle or something?
The beautiful and wise Marie... but he fights two knights, Blunel and Tarkus. And Blunel, or was it Blunel? Blue Bard? I forget it. It's Blue something. Anyway, that knight is actually a good dude. He wants to, you know, he has loyalty, he has honor, and he and Jojo actually have, like, a very compelling fight that ends in, like, a satisfying way that shows, like, you know, the blue guy isn't actually a dickhead in the end, and he has, like, his redeeming moment. And then Tarkus is like, I'm gonna kill everything! I'm gonna rape and murder children! Get over here!
I'm gonna chain to this neck and we'll go into the spirit facility so we do a tug of war with Chase with our next thing.
It's so... It is like the small hint you get of the weird, specific rules some JoJo fights will have, where it's like, we're gonna be chained around the neck, and there's this weird, complex set of rules that I'll have to then follow this one battle. So much time has been used to set this up. And it's really just there to give Zappelli his horrible, murderous, heroic death, which becomes, technically, spoiler Nick, this becomes a theme with the Zappellis that they don't have.
They all get cut in half by chain somehow?
They all die in horrible ways, basically. It's like a thing. The Zappellis just have horrific deaths.
Okay, can you also tell me if there are equivalents to Speedwagon, as in the character who seems like they'll be important, but then gets outshined by the random child sidekick?
I will tell you, Speedwagon is in the next part. So he's in there again.
Is there a second child psychic, or does Poku just show up again to moon people?
Actually, there is a child psychic who's even more racist than the Chinese character in this.
Great.
If it helps, the child characters stop around part 4.
Good. I would rather have Danny be the one to have opened up that gate so they could help JoJo.
It would have been fitting. Like, fucking Danny comes back.
His, like, burnt up corpse.
That is true, actually. And the Speedwagon found... Because essentially what will happen between parts 1 and 2 is the Speedwagon strikes it rich. And what will then happen is the Speedwagon Foundation exists to basically just help JoJo's. Like, and they reference them coming out to help them throughout time. So
he was helpful in the end.
Yeah, Speedwagon is a helpful character. He just isn't helpful in this part whatsoever.
It's like, why am I here?
I want to help.
There's a great bit where when Poku is first introduced, basically he's been hypnotized to act as a decoy. Like, he tries to, like, rob JoJo, and they chase after him using Haman. But it's actually just to lure them into a particular area for an ambush. So he, like, launches himself with this, like, makeshift catapult to snatch, I think, Zappelli's purse, and ends up, like, on the other side of this lake. And so Zappelli's like, we just have to use Hanma and project it into the bottom of our feet so we can get across. And he just starts, you know, dashing across the water. And JoJo falls after him, and he's you know, getting kind of up to his knees because he hasn't mastered it yet. And Speedwagon's like, okay, I'll also go too.
It just falls and sinks.
Where's Speedwagon?
Oh, man. I'm excited to get to the next part now, because I'm starting to remember things that happened in part 2, and I'm like, oh, God, I forgot about the hero Nazi in that one.
God.
The heroic Nazi who becomes Guile from Street Fighter.
I read a little bit of the second part, and Joseph seems like a way more interesting character than John.
That's the thing, is that I've read all the JoJo parts, and I read part 1 after I had read a couple of the JoJo parts before as well. So Jonathan always is the driest of the JoJo characters, and that's, you know, I reading it again, I see there is a bit more character to him than I remember. He is supposed to be like, burning gentlemanly passion! Oh! Like, it literally is how he uses some attacks, is he gets so fueled up with burning passion, it creates fire energy. And to that regard, he is kind of cool, but the other JoJo characters just have a lot more character to them, especially when you go to Joseph in the next one, who has an entire gimmick about being a liar and a cheater and a trick, and basically he's the inverse of Jonathan. He's like the anti-gentleman. He's always looking to play dirty tricks on you, and that it makes him very fun in that way. And then you go to, you know, Jotaro, who has like the badass gimmick and all that. Like, you get different characters within them. Jonathan is a lot drier, but I think that the first part, by and large, still has a lot to be enjoyed within it. But the biggest thing is that it needed to have something like Dio in it. This cartoonishly over-the-top villain that keeps it from being something forgettable. Like, you can't forget once you see him, like, I will shoot concentrated eye beams of vapor out of my eyeballs!
I don't think they ever actually explained how the fuck that even works.
No, they never do. He never has it when he comes back in part 3 either.
And you know what? That's how he kills Jonathan.
Yes!
It's just his random IV powers. Because they eventually finally get into Dio's castle. And it is a pretty badass fight, because basically Jonathan figures out, okay, so we can't actually touch him, but if I have something that I can, you know, project the Haman into, then I'll actually have a weapon that can hurt Dio. And so he takes a sword and he cuts Dio in half, straight down the middle, like down to his waist. But the sword still freezes because of Dio, so he doesn't kill him completely. And so Dio starts, like, draining Jonathan's energy. There's this awesome moment where his halves start to come together. And he, like, finishes this badass, you cannot kill this Dio because Dio is immortal!
He has to, like, oh, my face isn't completely... There we go.
Such an awesome moment. But Jonathan eventually manages to defeat him by setting his fist on fire so they can't be frozen. So fucking badass. And it looks like Dio is going to be killed because he falls off a cliff. He's got the Haman going through his body, destroying him. So he's like, I can't allow myself to die. So he just cuts his head off before the wave can reach all the way through his body, so his head survives. And he gets to actually kind of win.
Yeah, this is... There's a couple JoJo parts that end very bittersweetly. And it's one thing you will see as we go through JoJo is that most parts don't end with everybody surviving. Like, usually there's a couple fatalities along the way. But this is one of the other later parts, and one of the ones where you're like, huh, the villain kind of won in the end on this one.
Because he... Basically, because his body's been destroyed, so he hatches this plan to... take Jonathan's body. So Jonathan ends up marrying his girlfriend from the past.
Erina, basically defined as like, I will love you forever. And there's no character to her beyond that.
If she had shown up more, I think that she could have been interesting. But basically, there like a rift opens between them because Dio interferes, and then she only comes back because she's the nurse who's treating Jonathan at the end. And then they immediately just decide to get married and go to America. But while they're sailing to America, they have this, you know, it's like, oh, I'm so happy that I'm with you. I am happy that I'm with you. Oh, my love, and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, you know, Wang Chung is there still serving Jonathan. They, you know, get on board, and he vampirizes, like, the entire crew and takes over the ship. And he uses his random IV powers to just shoot through Jonathan's throat. And... he's like, I'm going to take over your body, and I am going to, you know, rule everything, essentially. But Jonathan manages to, with his gentlemanly powers, he somehow projects a wave into one of the zombies so that he will sabotage the steamship and cause it to be destroyed. And he, meanwhile, he's like, Erina, you must escape, which should sound like... But he's so manly, I guess, that he can still talk.
Yeah, manly passion Haman powers right through his throat.
So, they have this, you know, tearful goodbye, and, like, to prevent Dio from doing anything else, Jonathan just, like, grabs his head and he holds it down, and the ship sinks with the two of them together in it. But Dio's still alive because he's an immortal vampire head. Uh-huh. So, Jonathan's dead, and Erina survives, and she, like, takes, like, the child of, I guess, one of the sailors or one of the other passengers on the ship, who presumably will be tied into the next story, I guess.
Yes.
I'm assuming that was Joseph.
No, actually, technically what you'll find out is that Erina herself was pregnant at the time.
Oh.
So the Joestar line actually continues off from here, but the baby that she has there becomes a character in the next part as well.
Okay.
So that character does pop up. Erina herself actually shows up in the next part as well, and they give her a little bit more character, too.
Oh, that's good.
So, there's part one and part two are very connected. Some of the later parts, usually there's some tangential connection between some of the characters, and a few past ones will show up. Between parts one and two, there's actually going to be a lot of characters who kind of show up. Like, you probably forgot they existed, but Dire and Straits, who were Ton Petty's, like, other students... Yeah. Dire dies, but Straits actually shows up at the start of the next part.
Right. Dire has that weird split-legged, just to get your hand.
Yeah. Like, and he acts like it's the coolest strategy in the world, like, you've fallen into my trap!
I have pried your hands apart so you cannot block this technique. I froze you.
Shit! Oh, fuck! It's just like, what a goofy thing. But, no, I sincerely enjoyed part one. It has a crazy ending, and there are a lot of weird issues with it, certainly. One of the biggest is that the start of the series is prolonged. The first volume of the series is just them explaining Jotaro, or Jonathan and Dio's backstory, their origin. And then the final fight with Dio takes place over the span of, like, three chapters. Mm-hmm. And, like, in the process of that, you meet, like, four characters who are complete... You meet Tom Petty, Dire, and Straits, and none of them do anything to impact the story whatsoever. They don't, like, teach JoJo a new trick. They don't take out any lieutenants or something along the way. They just exist there to kind of die and then, like, be there at the end to wave them off.
They just kind of, like, show up and they, like, pretend to be vampires, so Jonathan starts to fight them, and they're like, wait, the fact that you hurt me means that you are actually Zeppeli's ally, so we shall help you. Where is Zeppeli, by the way? Well, because you waited so long to come and help us, he's, dead.
Yeah, his fate to be devoured by a lion just happened, so...
That's got pretty brutal, by the way. But overall, yeah, I did definitely enjoy this part. It was a nice introduction, I think, into JoJo, and it does, you know, leave me really looking forward to stuff that happens later on. You know, I'm looking forward to see Dio coming back, to seeing, you know, how the other protagonists are different from Jonathan, and how they do things differently, because I know that, you know, the Haman, which I still don't know how to pronounce.
Haman, yeah, I think.
Is, basically just gets phased out, I guess.
Haman will be in the next part, and then very briefly shows up in parts 3 and maybe a little of part 4, but it basically ends with Joseph, because that's when Stans take over, and that's when the series becomes all about Stans. But part 2, it's still all about Haman.
Oh, yeah, I mean, because...
And the vampire mask, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they explain that a little bit more.
Because, I mean, my understanding of Stans is that everyone has really weird powers.
It's not crazy in the start of part 3 where they appear, but as the series goes on, they get crazier, and then as you get into more parts, their powers get more and more obtuse. So like, at the start of part 1, they're not that bad. Like, I have super strength, I shoot fire, mine's a knight who's really fast, and then you'll get to later ones like, I can bring fucking animated characters to life, I fucking turns people into snails through subliminal messaging. They're very obtuse powers as time goes along. But that's part of the fun of it, is seeing like these crazy new powers and how everyone tries to survive it. But that's much further down the line. But I still recommend, if anyone's interested in JoJo, and if you're someone who's completely new to this and are kind of waiting to see what happens as we go along with this, if you haven't read it, definitely start with part 1. Because I think it's enjoyable on its own, but I think it's harder to enjoy once you've read the rest of the series and you start to find the stuff that's kind of, like, intrinsic to JoJo as it goes on. Like, if you go into it and you start to love Stans, going into a part that doesn't have it at all, it's a little bit harder to read. And especially if you go on to our later parts, you're like, oh, these JoJos are so full of character. And you go to Jonathan, you're like, huh, he seems kind of dull in comparison. It's just best to enjoy this part as it was meant to be, as the beginning to everything else, because you will enjoy it a lot more from that perspective, I believe.
So yeah, I quite enjoyed it, but yeah, definitely, part of it is the fact that it makes me look forward to more. If this had been just like its own, you know, standalone story, I think we'd have been alright, and I would have really liked Dio, but the fact that I know that it's leading into more really has me very excited. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so good stuff.
Yes. All right. Before we get into our recap, I wanted to follow up on something. We mentioned before about how next year, when we do our year-end recaps, we want to do like kind of awards beyond just best series. So I've come up with a couple superlative awards, Nick. And I just want to throw them out there. I'm a little sandbagging you with this, but I'm just going to see your opinion on some of these, okay?
All right.
So, like, I got some obvious ones. Best villain, best hero.
All right.
Those seem like easy ones. And I feel like if, you know, we like these and we pick them, basically what I can do is, as the weeks go on, if we see someone who kind of fits in these categories, I'll just type their name down and, like, the chapter or whatever, and then we can go back at year's end. So best villain, hero. Best speech. Like, best, like, cool speech, whatever. Maybe a villain speech or hero speech,
maybe,
whatever it is.
Or maybe just even a best line or something.
Something like that. Best power. Got to throw that in there. If something like that comes up, crazy power, because... You know, could pop up. Best fight.
All right, yeah.
Best new character.
Hmm.
And best new design. So that doesn't necessarily even mean a new character with a new design. Like, if Ichigo gets a new power-up design, we're like, that looks awesome or something like that.
Oh, that'll never happen.
Best two-page spread. I'm that one a little weird.
That was something I saw that someone suggested in an email, actually. I actually like that idea. I also like the title. Let me see if I can find the email so I can give credit, give props to the one who suggested it real quick.
Okay.
While
you're doing
that. Yeah, it's a GGBHTG who suggested calling it the 1-2 Punch Award. Because, you know, one page will be good, but, you know, the two pages together is really good.
So, okay.
Yeah.
There you go. I have some weirder ones here. Best WMR created character. So, like, the Toriko guy who hates food.
Like our favorite, you know, made-up backstory.
Like, Assy and the guy in Toriko who hates food. Biggest what the fuck moment. Which are just those scenes like Makarov getting teleported out of the kingdom. Just be like, what the fuck just happened? hottest fan service scene.
So, Fairy Tale, 50 times.
It's Fairy Tale competing against itself, essentially.
I think that that one is definitely one we're gonna have to do. Hottest fan service.
I'll keep these in track, then. If you have other ideas, feel free to send them in, people. But I'm going to start keeping track of this as the year goes on, and then we'll, at year end, we'll pick our favorites. And we'll give them out. And I feel like maybe we'll create a real award, and I'll add a category, Favorite Letterer of the Year, which we'll just always give to Annalisa so we have someone to physically give an award to at the end of things. And there we go, guys. So we'll do that for... we'll do it starting this week. So if any one of those categories feels like they get hit this week, then I'll add them to the list.
So should we also be considering suggestions that we do, or just...
We could. I feel like we definitely could, but it's going to be harder because we're like, yeah, we're giving our best new character 2016 to Joseph Joestar, a character who came out in 1989.
Well, not that one, but stuff like, you know, best hero, best villain.
Maybe. Yeah, best hero, best fight could be in there, and certainly biggest what the fuck moment, because I feel like we're going to have a lot of those when we talk about manga.
Right, right, right. That one especially seems like it. And maybe even also hottest fan service.
Yeah, there we go. All
right. Okay, yeah, that's it. I like that those though. Actually, I like all of them.
There we go. Cool. All
right. Yeah, but yeah, if you guys have more suggestions, we will definitely consider them. And if you suggest one that ends up making it in our year end, then we're also going to make sure to give you guys credit. So I've just made a note for the 1-2 punch for suggested by GGBHTG. There we go. Sorry. It's not something that rolls off the tongue if it's
just
a
letters in a row. Yeah, I know.
Maybe I'm supposed to say.
Probably. It's basically supposed
He's
to take
be
you.
Like, actually, it's pronounced Jorge.
Yeah, it's Joe. It's just an Arabic, you insensitive fuck.
All right. Let us get to the recap portion of Bleak Manga Recap. This has got to be a little bit weird because we do this on Wednesdays, and it's so great because we have we got a couple of days to process the official release, but also we do it before all the spoilers come out.
So at this point, we're basically only a day away from the next chapters coming out.
Right. So I'm sure you guys are going to be like, actually, this happens when we make predictions and stuff. Shut up. All right. Let's start off with Black Clover, page 45, to help somebody someday.
Feels like a Nickelback song. To help somebody someday, someone. Gotta help them out with my anti-magic swords.
Look at this mud golem.
Bleeding all over my face, in my little sister hot.
Now
he's Chad Kroger. He's about as likable as Chad Kroger.
Not nearly as Canadian, though.
Oh, he seemed perfectly Canadian.
He's
just like
too violent.
That is true. He is very violent.
So, Asta continues his whole speech of determination, refusing to back down in the face of Sally. And he tries to chop up the mud golem, and it nearly swallows him after he manages to cut it in half briefly. And then Gaush appears on his broomstick, kicking Asta out of midair. And he says, "You just almost died after yelling some really dumb stuff." Yes, that is what happened.
It's like, you nailed it.
Yeah. He says, like, all right, now that I've taken on, you know, Gaush, then he's, you know, heads up towards Sally, and he says, "I will take you on myself! I'll fight for the sake of Marie's love! And so she'll tell me I'm cool." He uses his double power in order to clone himself again, and launches this huge array of reflected lasers and stuff to blast the golem from all angles and so on and so forth.
And a pretty cool shot, too.
Yeah. But... it just recovers because, you know, it's made of mud. It just kind of regains its form and starts attacking him. And so Gaush is, you know, lamenting to himself, "Oh, God damn it, my magic doesn't work on that woman's, and I can't, you know, take it down because it just keeps on bubbling up and regenerating and so on and so forth." And and he mentions to himself, I haven't been this incompatible with an opponent since the captain. Should I use my trump card? No! No matter how strong my mirror magic gets, it won't help. And then he gets knocked out of the air. Yay! You're so cool, big brother. Asta protects him from a follow-up attack, and he then goes on. He has this really strained look on his face. I get the impression this is supposed to be Asta's, you know...
intense.
Yeah, you're not being really smart about this. You rely on me and we'll work together and stuff. But he looks like, what are you doing trying to get by yourself? You protect me and I'll help you.
It looks like he just drank a shit ton of coffee and it's all just hitting him at once.
His pupils are too small is the thing, you know. If he had, like, his normal sized eyes, then he would probably look, you know, more determined and shouty and stuff, but he really just looks like he's just... ah!
Just screaming, ah!
And then it sounds like he's, like, going insane, because the next page we see Gouge kind of reacting to this, because, you know, he starts off kind of nonplussed, but he's kind of, you know, smirking to himself because Asta's amusing him. But meanwhile, Asta's still shouting, he's like, ah, oh, you protect me and I'll protect you! That's an epic strategy if I do say so myself! What the fuck's wrong with you?
Asta's just gone insane on the side.
God. So, Gouge has a flashback to when he was a prisoner, and he had escaped from prison after, you know, of course he had been arrested for stealing so that he and his sister could survive, and he had been confronted by Captain Yami, and the captain, you know, just basically said, hey, you know what, you should join up with the Black Bulls, you know, you join my brigade, and then you'll be able to support her, you know, you'll be able to support her with your income and stuff. And Gouge is like, what? I don't trust other people. I'm not gonna do that. And so the captain said, that's okay. You don't have to trust me. Just protect what you want to protect, and someday that'll help somebody out. And Gouge just thinks to himself, he wonders if the captain knew that this would happen. And he says to Asta, well, I guess there's no choice, because if you guys die, it's gonna make Marie sad, so I'll protect you.
Character development, Nick!
Yeah, and you know what? This has actually been, you know, a few chapters ago, you said, we're going to learn Gouge's backstory, and it's going to make his whole sister complex thing, you know, seem way better. And I was like, no, he seems way too weird and perverted for that. And he has actually become one of the most compelling characters in this freaking series all of a sudden. So, you know, I think you came around to Black Clover a little bit earlier than I did, but it took us a little while, and I do see that with these side characters, we get more and more that are interesting, you know, like Fuego Leon and his brother, like the captain himself, like Gouge. Things I think are looking up for this series, and I really do think that this author has the potential to make this really good, if only Asta would stop being an annoying little shit. If Asta gets developed and he becomes a more likable character, like, you know, the flashes that we saw, like, during the dating, the triple date and stuff like that, then I think this could be a really good series. Mm. Yeah, this chapter did a lot to continue Gouge's development. We're not even done with it yet, because it gets into, you know, the fight after this. I just want to, you know, say that this was one of my favorite chapters this week, because of all the stuff we saw from Gouge.
This is a great chapter. I feel this progressed things in a lot of good directions. There's a lot of cool developments and teases to things in the larger universe, which I really like. I loved his line of like, oh, you know, I've been saving this for like if I ever had to fight the captain again. I forget his exact line, but he basically mentions like, oh, should I use the trump card? I haven't been this incompatible with an opponent since the captain is his line. And that's an interesting line to me, because I'm like, oh, now I'm starting to think about what the captain's magic is, and this teases something towards that, and the two of them have clearly fought at some point, or had an encounter. And
well, we see the end of the fight.
Yeah, we see that they do have a fight later on, but I just like teasing to this more of this world, and giving it to be like...
The captain's carrying this badass katana, too.
Yeah, and he, you know, his magic grimoire just covering here, like, what's his magic style that Gouche's magic abilities didn't work against him either, or something like that, and it's kind of cool, and this cool shot of, like, Yami with, like, the moon behind him. It just seems really cool.
So Asta's magic absorption sword pops out, and he's just like, oh, wait, this happened that one time, too. And I'm like, wait, you can't control that? Did they ever establish that he couldn't?
Yeah, he's been pointing out a lot, I thought.
Well, he used it all through that, because he... When did it first show up?
It first showed up when he fought the guy with, like, the magma armor or whatever it was, the fire right. and earth guy.
And then during the invasion, he used it that time too, didn't he?
Yeah, that's why I assumed he could just take it out, whatever.
So why the fuck is he surprised? He's used it in every single fight.
I'm assuming this is something that we've probably forgotten, but I don't remember when, basically.
So he launches this magical negation arc at the Golem thing, Sally gets really excited about this. Like, oh, I want to study more, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. And Gauch thinks to himself, maybe if we can hit that monster with a whole ton of simultaneous strikes so it doesn't have time to regenerate, we could do that. And the most effective attack we've used so far is the slash that Asta hit it with, but he can't launch too many. And then he's like, wait, I've always used my marriage magic to create copies of myself, but what if I use it on somebody else? And we get this narration that, you know, again, it's character development that says, you know, Gauch had always preferred to act alone, and he didn't trust people, and so he had never thought of using his magic to support someone else. But he began to rapidly visualize and develop a magic theory and create a spell that was fundamentally similar yet completely different and engraved a new page in his grimoire. Because apparently he's just that awesome.
Well, again, we don't know how magic... It's still a very nebulous system of magic in this world that I guess people can... I don't know if, like, your growth and creates new spell, if you have to find fairies to create new spells, if you yourself can develop new spells and then create them into the page. I still don't understand how magic works in this world, but it seems cool. Like, he just creates one on the spot and then engraves it into his book. Good for him.
So, he tells Teresa to hold off the enemies while he buys some time. And so he's like, all right, I guess I really will have to use this in order to get the magic necessary to do that. He lifts up his bangs that are always covering his left eye and reveals this mirror eye, a magic item that's in his left eye, and he stares at Asta with it and uses it to create a new form of mirror magic and creates an entire squadron of Astas! Kage Bunshin no Asta! We're not Naruto! Just because Asta's like Naruto and freaking... I've forgotten his name. Not Yuno, is it?
Which one are you talking about?
Asta's rival.
Oh, Yuno, yeah.
It is Yuno, okay. Just because Yuno was like Sasuke and Asta's like Naruto, and Asta has been cloned, does not mean we're like Naruto.
I've heard people make this complaint before. I do not get it, though. Because I feel like it's... One, it's a temporary thing. Like, he needed Gauch to create this, essentially. But also, just on top of it, doesn't seem like something... Like, I feel like creating duplicates of yourself is something like it's like a base power in a lot of series, too. It's like someone who have the ability to shoot fire or something to me.
It's just confirmation bias, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, you start seeing similarities, and then you see that the main character has suddenly used the same technique that is the signature technique of the character he's been compared to. It's like,
But that said, and I'll, you know what? I'm going to even start... I'm going to put it on the list right now. The two-page spread with Asta going to work with the mirror slash is pretty fucking cool. Like,
I actually don't like that one very much. I like the one where the brigade is first summoned and they're all charging forward.
Well, can you count that as a two-page spread?
Because it doesn't take up the whole thing. I mean, it goes across two pages. I like that one, but I really don't actually like the one with all the intersecting slashes. It's... I don't know. Somehow it seems too crowded. It's weird.
So can I not add it to the list, then?
You can do whatever you want.
No, I don't want to. It's going to be a fight between us, and I don't want to break... I don't want this to be our Yoko Ono that breaks us up. I'm like, no, Nick didn't like the mirror slash. I loved it. Now we don't talk to each other. I've removed his number from my phone.
Behind the manga.
Behind podcasts. I just want to say, I really love this chapter. I think it was great all the way through. I think the end is really exciting. I love the teamwork between Gauch and Asta. I think what makes this cool, what makes this exciting, what makes this like a fuck yeah moment, is because it's two characters working together, and there's development in there that you can get something from their characters on. Gauch didn't want to. Before this, Gauch didn't like Asta at all. And seeing the two of them kind of grow and develop into this point where they use the strategy combo together... And even Gauch himself had to explain why he got to this point. Like, he's like, well, I can't just use this ability on myself because creating as many clones of myself as I want still doesn't change the fact that I'm not compatible against this enemy. I can't do anything against her. So it shows that they're both, you know, at least Gauss rather, is intellectual. He's thinking this fight through. And the two of them, you know, teaming up, it's kind of the thing we always loved about, like, early Naruto or, you know, series like that where you're like, oh, these characters are actually working together and using strategy to defeat this person. It makes the fights that much more cooler and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really liked this chapter. It was good. It was good. And, I can't believe that they, you know, took Gauss and actually had his character develop to this extent while keeping, you know, his defining traits consistent and applying that, you know, to the way he changed. So, good stuff.
Yes, very much so.
Let's move on to Bleach, because... oh, God.
I want to note, though, I feel this was a good week of Jump all around, so... this is going to be an interesting discussion.
Bleach is just weird, because...
I think part of the reason
Bleach is kind of pulling a Toriko on us right now, where it's kind of like, just got to do a bunch of stuff, so let's just jump between it all the time.
Here's the thing, I think the reason why I like Bleach this week is because I called it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, last time, Asuka Nakvar got super punched in the face by Yushiro, and then revealed that he was completely unharmed because he could just change the lethality of whatever is by absorbed a whole ton of, so he absorbed a whole ton of Kibo, and now, it doesn't work. So, but, then Yorichi actually observes that, his flesh is actually healing from burn scars, and, Asuka Nakvar says, well, of course they are! The fatal dose amount going up means I've become immune to your attacks. That's not how that works! Just because you can change how much of something it takes to kill you does not mean it suddenly becomes medicine. That's different. That would be pretty great to have, but that's different from what you said it was. Don't lie to me.
I think that's exactly how it works, Nick.
So Yushiro rushes in again. He punches Asuka Nakvar. Doesn't use spirit pressure this time, just kind of punches him, which seemed to work perfectly fine last time. And so Asuka Nakvar is just completely unaffected, and he's like, oh, you tried to do that already. And then arrows shoot into Yushiro from above and dad through the chest, and he's all hurt super bad. But you said that you change... Can you... If you get punched enough, can you change the lethality of punches? That seems different from what you said before.
Well, no, because he's presumably he's punched him with spiritual pressure, and now it just doesn't hurt him. I don't know why it didn't create an explosion like before, because it should have created still the explosion. He just wouldn't be hurt by it.
Right.
But for some reason...
He would be healed by it.
Yeah. But for some reason...
You don't see that. You just see Yushiro punch him, which we saw him do before, and Asuka was like, oh, God, stop it! Did he... Can you change the lethality of punches?
I hope that's his power.
I've changed how many punches it takes to hurt me. What if I kick you? Nobody, don't do that.
Ow! Oh, shit! it's different.
So, Yushiro is hurt super bad. And Asuka Nakvar brags. He says, oh, no, it's too late. It took longer than I expected for you guys to comprehend my ability. And that's fatal.
Please, chapter 658, Fatal Matters are called.
No, actually, Chris, you gotta do a Bleach.
I don't know why Bleach the title's upside down.
For no reason.
None of these characters have the ability to invert gravity or anything like that.
If it were a Hirako chapter, then you could be like, okay, they're playing around by flipping the title over. But no! No one has an inversion technique. Unless you're saying Asuka Nakvar's dosage thing is whatever.
I love Fatal Matters are Cold. I swear to God, guys, when Bleach ends, I am going to do a top 10 on the top 10 greatest Bleach chapter titles, and Fatal Matters are Cold is probably going to be on there. Because my first thought when I read it, I was like, fecal matters are cold?
Well, yeah, if you let them sit for a while.
Yeah. Eventually they get cold, like everything.
So, then we cut away from this, as Yorichi clutches her brother's body, to Gerard.
Obviously.
Okay. I'm just going to jump back over now. So, Kiori and Hachi are hiding away from Gerard while he's just kind of going around and leaning on buildings, crushing stuff, and talking to himself. It must have been, like, a prerequisite to enter the four elite in order to guard you, Ibaki. You had to talk to yourself. It took Fernita a long time to get the hang of doing it.
Yeah.
So, Gerard just starts going around, like, "Oh, you may be captains, but against my miracle, you are all helpless. And your spirit breaches are so faint I can barely sense them. Now I have to rummage through this rubble in my godlike stature to find those of you who still remain." Okay.
Smash, 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 smash.
Hiyori eventually finally jumps out, and she says, she's like, "You stop talking about miracles. It's just a bunch of gibberish, Baldy." And with his long, flowing locks, Gerard's like, "I am not bald!
I'm not bald!"
But Hiyori, remember her whole thing? You probably don't even remember this.
I didn't. This made no sense to me. I was like, why did she call him bald if he's not?
I want to say this was like 500 chapters ago, even though it clearly wasn't. It must have been like less than 400. But when she was training Ichigo for his, you know, hollow training, she just has a habit of insulting people by calling them baldy if they don't have facial hair. And that's her thing.
Oh my god.
That's what separates her from all of the other pigtailed tsunderes in this series, is her focus on bald faces.
That's her gimmick that separates her.
So, Gerard knocks her Sero away, and then he's like, "Oh, you thought that would work, but no, the other visor show up in order to attack Gerard from behind. She was just a distraction." And so we get their techniques, and so Lisa uses Nijuichijo Tombokudareis. I pronounced that horribly, which is like Dragonfly Descent. And I forget if this is Love or Rose. I think it's Love.
This is Love.
Love is like Hifuki no Kozuchi, Fire Mallet. And Hachi's like Chocolate Bar Slider.
Fucking Love Hachi. I don't remember what this dude does. I know he killed Baragon, but...
Bullshit.
I was like, he had like a candy gimmick before.
His thing is that he was one of the higher ups in the Kido Corps.
I know that, but I don't remember why is it called Chocolate Bar Slider? What a weird gimmick for his naming convention.
Whatever. So they wound Gerard, and then he's just like, "Remember that whole thing about my wounds increasing my size? Yeah, it turns out hurting me didn't do anything." Just whap! Knocks them all away. And then he's just like, "You know what? This is getting really annoying. I know. I'll just, you know, collapse this entire area and bring them all crashing down." He just goes to punch the ground. And then his arm freezes! And from a nearby convenient perch, which has, like... it's made of ice spires.
It is.
Which means that he made this platform just so that he could look down at Gerard and look badass.
It's like that whole thing in The Dark Knight Rises where you're like, wait, Batman stopped to set up like a flaming bat signal on the bridge while Bane's people were murdering their way through Gotham? It's the same thing. Like, he's murdering the fucking captain guards, but it's a guy who's like, "I need to make some ice bridges to stand on them to look cool."
Can you imagine if, like, Gordon had set fire to that signal and, like, half of it were kind of all collapsed and stuff, and he's like, "Yeah, it turns out it's really, really hard to paint with gasoline."
Turns out that's not so easy. Ah, shit. Hold on, wait. Nobody look. I'm gonna wipe it off and start again. Then...
Oh, no, no. It looks like a penis. No.
Gordon, then I'm gonna say, go, and... tell the bad guy to say some ominous line about Batman once again. Then you drop the... I'm just gonna do that. You guys got it. I'm explaining it too much. It's ruining the moment.
How did I get the money to do this when all of my personal assets have collapsed? And why did my personal assets collapse with Wayne Enterprises? You would think I would have, like, you know, some personal fortune for my family or something. This movie was kind of shit.
I sucked a lot of dicks to get back from whatever Middle Eastern whole country I was stuck in. But I don't talk about that because that's not cool like Batman. That doesn't make me look like a badass.
Batman, you're so cool.
Sucking dicks, grow up, honorable of you.
Batman's totally badass, yes. Yes, it's totally a big deal I broke his back.
Yeah, I destroyed you, and you definitely are the coolest one. I'm definitely not going to go out getting shot by Wonder Woman on a motorcycle.
Actually, this Catwoman, whatever!
Oh, much worse.
So anyway, hits the guy just... showed up, and he says, Kyoraku and a number of the assistant captains should still be there. I can't allow you to let them fall. Stay frozen here forever.
Dun, 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 dun.
Not nearly as amazingly memorable a line as, that's fatal.
He needs a gimmick. He should have had something like, keep cool, big dickhead, or something.
It's not like turn this guy into freaking Arnold, Mr. Freeze, or something.
Yeah, he's just like, you want to know the key of the dinosaurs? And his whole arm freezes. The Ice Age!
Stay frozen there.
Keep frosty, bitch. He just adds insulting lines at the end of it.
Oh, God.
Chill out, you big bucket to dump.
This 12-year-old insults.
He is 12.
Well, he's physically 12.
Yeah.
So that was Bleach. It looks like we're going to be jumping around between a few different things as we continue forward here. Because apparently, neither Asuka Naklavar versus the She-Hulk nor Gerard versus everybody else are interesting enough to focus on for very long. So we have to jump between them to keep things interesting. But
I did call it. I did call Hitsugaya would be the one to fight Gerard.
Yeah, you did.
Now, we'll see if that actually pans out. He can get bitch slapped the next chapter. I'm like,
imagine, wow, you're even smaller than the others. But I have ice powers.
You just see like a tiny speck flying through space for the rest of the series, and that's him.
Does this count as a design change?
Yes, technically.
Because Hitsugaya has the coat from when he was a zombie, but he's not.
It does. It does technically. Do you want to put it on there?
We have to keep track of the design changes, I guess.
Alright, so I'll put it on there. New character design, Hitsugaya, new coat.
And then new jacket.
New jacket. And it was what, Bleach 648?
658.
So I'm just going to put that on here. 658, January. It was what, the 18th, I think, was this week. So cool. There we go. Now we have one entry onto our list already.
Yay.
This list is shaping up. Okay.
Let's do Fairy Tail.
Yes. All right. So we actually have...
Fairy Tail really pissed me off.
We have two chapters of Fairy Tail talk about this week. So first is chapter 468, Memory of the Stars. And the cover page is a bunch of what's her name and her celestial spirits and the people she gave them to, essentially. So...
Hello?
Yeah, Layla. I forgot the mom's name. So, last time, it was Aquarius showed back up, and she saved Lucy after she found out, basically, the quote-unquote past between her and her mother and Brandish's mother. You know, Brandish was like, no, your mother was a monster who stole the key from me and my mother and then killed her, and it was, you know, your family's a bunch of monsters, and it was a rivalry between them. So Aquarius shows up to save Lucy at the end of the last chapter, and they have a tearful reunion where they're hugging, and it's kind of sweet. And, Brandish says something like, oh, so you're here too? And apparently, like, I guess there's some weird gimmick where Aquarius yells at her and demands that she be called, like, ma'am or master. And then when she does, she's like, oh, and now walk on all fours and bark like a dog. Because I have to get my BDSM fetishes in here in this chapter.
Which is weird, because he then goes on to do all sorts of mermaid fetish stuff later on, so it's like, wow, you're doubling down there, hero.
A lot of butt shots, yeah, it's the whole thing. I'm just going to try to ignore that part of it, because it's a lot to get to otherwise.
We've got two chapters to talk about.
Yeah, basically, Aquarius turns them both into mermaids so that they can then go through the mermaid time stream thing. And their goal is to basically go into the past and learn the truth about what happened between Brandish's mother and Lucy's mother. And we see Lucy's mother. Or actually, no, this isn't Lucy's mother. I think this is basically a much further ancestor to Lucy's family. Anna Hartfelia. Which is weird that the Hartfelia name has been passed down that long. Because you feel like eventually she would have taken... I don't know, maybe that's not how marriage works in their world. Maybe you just always keep your maiden name. But it basically talks about how there was a deal made way back when between Xerath, the Celestial Mages, and the dragons. And it all played into the giant doorway, the Gate of Zodiac that we found out about during the Grand Magic Tournament arc that Future Rogue came out from. And it was meant to be, you know, guarded by the keys, and that's kind of what played into it. And that's why Layla, when she retired, essentially gave three of the keys away. But she had to do it under the assumption that maybe she would need the keys again one day to essentially open the door and use its power. And that they did come, and she basically set out to get those keys back. And two of them did, but unfortunately, one of them couldn't, because the message just couldn't get to Brandish's mother. And because of that, Layla had to open the door without all 12 keys. She only had 11. She used her energy for it to open the door. But because of that, she became horribly frail and sick. But it doesn't end there, Nick. It's super sad, because then Brandish's mother shows up and is crying because she didn't get the message in time. Brandish's mother is so sad. She's like, after all the kindness you showed me, I've inflicted such pain upon you. And Layla's like, don't get angry about yourself. It's not your fault. And in this state, I can no longer wield celestial spirits. And Brandish's like, well then let me give the key to Lucy. Let me pass my love down onto my children. And I hope that our daughters, too, will one day be best friends. And, oh, it's... It ends with the line
it's
of, like...
It's a fairy tale, isn't it? Yeah.
It ends with, like, the line of, Layla, like, I hope our daughters will be great friends with one another. And Brandish's mother's like, I hope so. No, I'm sure they will, too. And, of course, you know, Layla and Brandish are literally watching this happen. And we then cut away to another scene where, basically, Brandish's mother is walking away from this. And this is the part that just pisses me off to no end, because it's... Alright, so Brandish's mother is walking away, and we see someone with a knife behind her. And then we see it's Zoldio, which is one of the three other, or one of the other two caretakers of Layla that she gave one of the keys to.
I completely forgot about this guy.
I only figured it out from context clues, but yeah, it's one of the three, because you also see her in the cover page at the start. I think it's the one she gave Capricorn to. And she stabbed Brandish's mother. And she's crying. She's like, it's all your fault. Miss Layla's dying because of you. And it's like, you know, Brandish's like, you're right. It is my fault. This is what I deserve. And she's like, how dare you take her from this? And all that Layla or Brandish's mother could say is, I beg of you, Zoldo, my daughter Brandish, please spare her life in exchange for my own. Will you grant me this one wish? And Zoldo is crying now because she realizes what she's done. She's killed Brandish's mother only because she loved Layla so much, and it's a misunderstanding of loving just, oh, what love can do to you, Nick! It's...
And then Brandish is like, no, mother, no! And they break out of the vision, and Lucy's hugging her, and Lucy's like, maybe the two of us can be best friends from now on.
Just like our mothers. And it's so, like, I don't... I never liked that notion of, like, someone loves someone so much that they're driven to kill someone out of love. Like, it just seems like always like a hackneyed storytelling thing.
Specifically for, like, revenge, but yeah, it is...
In this case, it just feels like a forced explanation as to why someone killed her that wasn't Lucy's mom, but still attach it to that. Right. And it's like, oh, I'll just use one of the two characters involved in that who has no relevance now and make her the bad guy, but I don't want to create her a villain because I don't want to bring her up later on, so she regrets her decision or whatever. You're like, oh, this... I don't know. It instantly loses me in that regard because it's so cringy, kind of narmy. Like, this is just silliness. But then Happy shows up and he screams, help me, please! Natsu is dying. He just passed out all of a sudden, so somebody needs to save him.
This is the chapter that really pissed me off.
So this is chapter 469, what I want to do. And the cover page is, I don't know, one of the Celestial Spirit Mages.
I'm pretty sure it's Yukino.
Yukino. Yeah, well, it gives a fuck. I don't even think she shows up in this chapter.
Remember, she's the one who Lisanna got pissed off because she's the short silver hair and little sister character.
She's like, hey! Hi!
That's my finish!
Why? So they basically explain what happened. You know, Natsu was fighting Zeref, we had to run away, and now he's fallen down, and they're like, I don't hear a heartbeat. And that's when Fairy Tail's, like, friendly mage person healer, who I don't remember her name, shows up, and she's like, oh, he's dying, and there's a...
He's got magic cancer.
He has a magic tumor, essentially, and, like, there's surgery is the only way we can heal him. Because I guess Wendy's magic would work, I don't know. But, like, the only way to get out is surgery, but there are no surgeons in the world with skills that precise. It simply couldn't be. And then Brandish is like, take these handcuffs off, because I'll use my magic to shrink his cancer so small it evaporates. Essentially, it just erases it from existence. And they do just that. They take her handcuffs off. She uses it to heal, to shrink the tumor out of existence. And then afterwards, she's like, just give me my coat back, and you can put the shackles back on me, and I'll go back to being a prisoner.
Natsu had super cancer for 10 pages!
Lonnie Tim barely survived super cancer!
Super magic tumor! Oh, he's going to die unless we find a surgeon capable of removing it, and there's nothing that exists on this continent! We'll have to travel! I'll shrink it so he'll survive. You'll do that for us? Yes, because Lucy and I are best friends.
We're besties now. I realized I did no groundwork in researching how my mother actually died. I saw her corpse had a bunch of stab wounds, and I just assumed that somehow that's how your mother got her. Even though your mother was sickly at the time. Look, I never claimed to be the world's greatest detective. So yeah, Brandish has gone back to her cell, and Lucy comes to talk to her, and basically is like, you didn't need to do this, you know, you can come out and join us. She's like, no, I'm, you know, you're still your prisoner, you're naive, you know, I don't want to be your friend, you know, that we're not buds yet, essentially. And Aquarius is just like, she needs more time, and, you know, they go away. And this is the actual moment I do like in this chapter. Because after all that silliness is done, Aquarius sits down and has this kind of conversation with Lucy, where she's like, look, I told you I can only be here very briefly because you don't have my key. My key has been reborn somewhere else in the world. And I don't know where it is. It might be in Ishgal, it might be in Alakatasa, it might be on some other continent. And I can't give you any hint to its whereabouts. And Lucy's like, I know, but I'm going to find you because you're one of my best friends. And then Aquarius fades away. And Lucy thinks to herself that now she has something to do after all this is done. So she has a reason to win this fight. Because she has a mission for a friend that she needs to survive this to do it for her. And I'm like, that's a cool little character moment. And I like that. If you had to bring Aquarius back, I'm glad it's for a moment that gives us a character moment for Lucy going forward. You know, this story might not continue past this arc. But it gives the idea that the story is not going to end for these characters here. And I like that.
I
don't really
understand how
Korea's
get back at all, but...
No, I had no idea. I mean, I know Celestial Spirit Mages that sometimes just pop up at places. But then we get to the other part of this chapter that pisses me off. So we cut back to the battle outside, where Lamia Scale and Mermaid Heal are fighting against the Wall and the other chick whose name I'm never going to remember. DeMaria, that's it, DeMaria. And Kagura, the samurai chicken mermaid heel, is in her tent, very upset. She's sitting there, she's got a frown on her face. And we flash back to our fight with DeMaria, where DeMaria had slashed her with her sword so many times that she cut all of Kagura's clothes off except for her underwear. And she was shamed in battle as all the men fighting in the war turned and saw her naked body. And it was so shameful. And DeMaria, you are a cretin for doing such. And that's basically why she's hanging out in her fort right now. She's so ashamed with herself that everyone saw her nude. And you're like, good God, this is like character assassination. Which annoys me because fucking Hiro has done this before. There was in Rave Master, there was one character, Julia, who was like a female martial artist. And she fought against some weird character who had the ability, like a fat Mexican wrestler who had the ability to, like, exhale, like his breath could disintegrate clothes. And his thing was he would use it on women so that they would be so shamed from battle that they'd run away. And the whole thing there was that he used it against Julia, like, a couple times, and then eventually she rips her own top off because she's like, I'm a warrior. I don't give a fuck about you taking my clothes off. I'm going to beat you anyway. And it was...
That's actually pretty badass.
It's badass, but it's, like, a weird kind of badass, because, like, right. This is fan service-y as shit, but I got it. But she's like, look at this. She's like, I feel like this is going to end in relatively the same way, but God, I hate that we have to go through the same beats, because this is dumb as shit. And we see Bradman and all that stuff, and then it cuts away to the four holy saints who have been beaten by the god Serena, and that's kind of where the chapter ends with...
His hair is stupid.
His hair is very stupid. I forget his name. The tree dude. Wardle or something like that. He basically thinks that, like, Werot, sorry, is like, oh, you know, Mavis, I'm sorry, and I'm going to join the rest of you. Goodbye. And Mavis has, like, a fucking force voice. She's just like, oh, I hear a great dying voices going somewhere far, far away. And that's the end of the chapter.
I'm sure he's totally dead.
Yeah, he's dead and never coming back, Nick. And like Rebecca, he won't show up either.
Yeah. He's going to be like Unohana and Rebecca and never come back or be important.
Yeah, he's never going to be an important character.
I got those in.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie, those are some pretty rough chapters.
Terrible.
They're not the worst things in the world, but in a week of where I feel Jump had almost nothing but good chapters, it was tough to go through two chapters of Fairy Tail that were pretty slow, plodding, and full of stupid.
Especially after we had a few moments in Fairy Tail that were actually quite good. You know, like the conclusion of the fight between Erza and Desert Guy and the confrontation between Natsu and Zeref and so on and so forth. To just go, you know, it's like, oh, but friendship and cancer shrinking and the tumor's gone because we're suddenly friends now, except Brandis is going to sort of be ambiguous now. And also clothing damage.
Yeah. That's the most annoying part, is like, I know where this plot is going to go to. It's like, ugh.
Alright. Well, let's move on then to Food War Shokugeki no Soma. Last time, it's chapter 150, Games. Last time, people at the Polar Star Dome were celebrating because of Soma's victory, and Erina was kind of contemplating the nature of the dorm. And then suddenly a zombie showed up at the front door in a really creepy full-page spread. And so a zombie asks Soma if Erina is in the building, and Soma just kind of goes, huh, what if she is? It's a little bit douchier than actually I'm kind of used to Soma being. What you got to do about it, old man?
Well, yeah, well, try to stop me.
He's like... So the zombie just walks right past him and goes and finds Erina, who of course starts to freak out because he's there, and all of the residents of the dorm are like, yeah, get out of here! Leave her alone! And Ishiki steps forward, still in his naked apron, because that's how you want to confront your enemies.
That's how you want to confront your boss, your principal.
So zombie says, I'm just here to speak with Erina. She says, well, could you come back later on? Because, you know, we're celebrating now. And Azami just turns towards Erina and just goes, come here. Just like, there is no word bubble. It's just a black mist appears in the
face. A black miasma appears, declaring his words.
And, like, there's this really creepy panel of her, like, you know, shrinking, you know, neck near him as he reaches a hand out towards her. He's covered in shadow. And he just kind of taps her on the head and says, oh, I'm glad to see you're doing well.
Such a fuck.
He's such a good dad, you know, looking after his daughter. But, you know, just the way it's drawn and stuff, you know, of course, references all the horrible history between them. So he basically just says, you know, yeah, I just wanted to talk to her, you know, keep going, you know. Yeah, just take good care of her while she's staying here and stuff. And all the others are like, hey, you know, we know what's going on here, and guy whose name I don't bother to remember with sideburns is like, we heard about the horrible things you did to Erina. And then Fumio appears. And she says that to Izami that he has no rights to come there. And she says, it's appalling what you've done, Nakamura. And everyone's like, Nakamura? And so we get some more explicit history about Izami, stuff that we had seen before with the, what was it? I forget the guy's name. The guy who was actually the top seed, the ball.
Daimo or
something along those lines. It begins with a D. I forget it currently, but when we saw the photo of he and Izami and Juichiro were the top three, and we get a full explanation of who he is, because they say, oh yes, he's a Polaris alum, and Ishiki goes on to explain, yes, I actually did some research into his history. Dojima, okay. And so they say, like, oh yes, he was the third seed of the Council of Ten in the fall of only his first year in high school. He had taken the first seat by his second year, and that by itself was enough to guarantee his stardom in the highest circles of the culinary world, but he wasn't satisfied. So he looked for a place within the gastric godfather's own family. After his graduation, he married a lady of the Nakiri family and was given the Nakiri name himself. Given his skills, his track record, and his status, he was a world-class culinary star who all believed was eminently worthy of the honor, until Sir Senzaemon banished him from the Institute and struck his name from the family records. Interesting that he took on that family name, but I guess that's actually more common with, like, noble families and stuff.
Yeah, it is heard of that men will take the name of the wife.
Especially if they're taking,
a more prestigious name, yeah.
So everyone's like, oh my god, I can't believe he did that before, by the time he was our age, and so on and so forth. But that, of course, also makes people wonder, why then does he want to actually shut down the dorm if he used to live there? And he just says, oh, I didn't attempt to shut them down specifically. It just happened to be among the groups I wanted to see disbanded. So, didn't really care. Also, by the way, you haven't won yet. You're okay for now, but the true game is only just beginning. True, you did defeat Azon and protect your dormitory from his machinations. Machinations is a wonderful word, by the way. However, Central remains...
Isn't that machinations?
I thought it was machinations. I guess it's machinations.
We might both be pronouncing it wrong. His sinister machinations.
It's actually machinations?
Well, we have the internet, Nick. We can just type it in. Machinations. How to pronounce it. Let's go to dictionary.com. They have to have a thing there.
Machination.
Machination. So machinations.
Machination sounds more fun. Machinations.
Sounds like a nut.
It does, actually. The elite pieces I have personally chosen and gathered to my cause are making steady advances across the battlefield that is the Totsuki Institute. And we see a chessboard.
I love this. It's not just that the other pieces have been taken, they've been physically destroyed. You just see crumbles of, like, fucking pawns and bishops on the ground.
I'm just thinking to myself, wait, so is it your turn or is it theirs? Because if it's their turn, it's stalemate. That means you don't win.
Ooh.
Like, I checked the board and I was like, that king can't move anywhere. So if you're trying to actually do a checkmate, then you better hope it's your turn still. But yeah, he's like, it's only a matter of time before you find yourself in checkmate. And then my ideal, my true gourmet, will rule the entire game board. Bye.
Yeah, later. Take care of my daughter. Can you please get her out of that nightgown?
Give her some more clothes. I'll take some of her clothes so that she'll actually, like, not look like a helpless maiden all the time.
Has she changed since that week she's been here? Because I saw the first day, and she was also wearing that nightgown.
Has she been attending classes?
Yeah, what's up with it? Has she been doing anything?
I know that I said she didn't have to attend classes, but she hasn't been attending my personal lessons in place of them either, so...
Yeah, I feel like one of the two...
Has she discovered soap operas? Is that what she's doing now? Don't let her watch those. They're terrible.
Is she just eating bullshit all day?
Spanish language ones.
Tell them to wave us. Those are amazing. And she learns a new language at the same time. It's perfect.
Suggestion to Zami. Weird parent Zami. right, so he goes outside. I don't know if his driver has a name yet. He does. Because he showed up before when he was talking about Arina and what they're doing about her. But the guy says, are you actually okay with not bringing Miss Arina back? And so he's like, no, I'm fine with it. She will return to me on her own. My training has embedded its roots too deeply within her for her to do otherwise.
Dun, 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 dun.
You're back to creepy now. But, yeah. Then, as he's about to get into the limo, suddenly someone comes out and approaches him. And so Azumi's like, well, what are you doing out here? And someone says, oh, you know, I just got a stupid question, if you don't mind me asking. You lived in the dorm, but didn't you, you know, come out of it with any, you know, fondness or attachment to the place when you left? And Azumi gets this really weird smile on his face, and then he says, the world I wish to create does not exist in this building, at least not anymore. When I was a student, I lived here together with a senpai I greatly admired. A visionary. His dishes were as audacious and unprecedented as they were delicate and refined. Every plate he created gleamed with culinary gold. To this day, the time I spent together with him warms my heart at some of my most treasured memories. And he had the most amazing thing. I mean...
what a great cock. Well, I mean... Oh, no.
Chicken. Yeah. Yeah.
He was really good at making chicken that I put in my mouth. And suck dry. Got it. Quick recovery.
Yeah, totally not gay. No. I have a daughter. Yeah. totally mine. he's like, oh yeah, he was so great. Not like the students here now. I must admit, coming here has taken me back a little. Ah, the days of Polaris' golden age when I lived here together with Saiba Senpai. And this catches someone's attention. As he goes on, I was like, oh, yeah, he was so great. The
blood. Oh, my beloved youth, I love the being here.
So wonderful. And someone starts to say, actually, I don't know if you know this, and Arina, for some reason, is dashing to the front door, I guess, to talk to her father, too.
Or probably to stop someone from talking to him, I guess.
Maybe so he won't say something stupid, like he might be doing in a second. When we get this big two-page spread as Arina just opens the door in time for someone to say, Joichiro of Saiba? That's my dad. So, there you go. He just kind of like nonchalantly reveals it, which I love that that's the way that that's the big secret reveal, is because someone just didn't think to bring it up before, so now he just is.
Yeah, he didn't realize it before, like, oh yeah, you were there with my dad, and that's the one you like so much. But I like that it's like a goofy comic, like it's a comical reveal, because like, it's not like someone has a cool face on, like he's like blankly staring.
No, every single face in this, you know, what we see of Azumi's, Arina's in the doorway, and Soma's too, are all weird, goofy expressions in different ways.
Like it's you see, like fucking Azumi's got like his arms spread out, like he's still in the fucking moment of being like grandiose and flowery with his language, like oh, the times of my youth, the times spent working on our machinations of food.
Wait, what?
And
he's your fucking dad. What? Like,
oh.
And so we're just kind of like...
Oh.
So we're just kind of like, yeah, he's my dad.
I just love that his arms are still thrust out in a grand gesture, and he's just at the face like, what?
So yeah, the secret's been revealed, and I guess soon we're going to find out how the Nihiris are going to deal with this upstart kid being
this
related
punk
to an idol of theirs.
What time do you have to go to work, by the way? Because we've been running for almost 2 hours.
Hey, I don't have to go for like 5 more hours.
Okay, I was like, do we need to pick up the pace?
So I liked Food Wars this week, but a lot of it was just kind of people explaining stuff to each other. So, And all stuff that we actually already knew, really.
Yeah, this is only a reveal to the people in the group. You know, we are, as the audience, already knew this, or should have known this.
I am looking forward to the fallout from it, but the reveal itself is just going to be like, oh, I wonder what's going to come from that. That's what's most interesting about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So should we head to My Hero Academia then?
Yes, I believe we should.
That's chapter 74. I forget what it's titled. Hang on a sec. Smoke Signal. There we go. So, last time the villain attack on the training camp was starting to get into full swing. but as we see in this chapter, still not everyone knows about it yet. And Aizawa, that's his name, is leading all the remedial students to their extra lessons. And he's like, all right, you know, we're going to drill you on what to do in emergency situations. You should reflect on, you have to reflect on yourselves, you know, not being aware of how much you're falling behind the others is only going to widen that gap. So, you know, think on that. And then they get inside the door, and that jerk from Class B is there. And he says, ha! The stupendous Class A managed to produce 5 whole failures, while Class B had only a single one!
So he's bragging. He's shitting on them despite the fact he's the one idiot in their class.
I love that. He looks all triumphant and weird, but just, and they're like, but you're here, you idiot!
What the fuck?
But then at that moment, as the remedial lessons are going to get started, suddenly they get a message from from Mandalay with her telepathy quirk, and learn them. Oh, we're under attack by villains, and there might be more. So Aizawa, you know, says, "Okay, you know, stay behind. You know, guard them to the to Class A's teacher. I gotta go, you know, protect the students." And he dashes outside, and he sees the forces on fire, and then the scarred up kid, whose name I still haven't remembered. Is there waiting for him, and he just says, huh, you're always worrying about others, huh, Eraserhead? And immediately attacks him before Aizawa can even react. Just fire.
Screams out blood, too, which is interesting.
I think Aizawa screams blood.
Does he?
I think so, because...
Why would he scream blood?
I'm not sure.
Is that part... Maybe.
Is that its name?
Dobby? People saying his name's Dobby. Mm. So I wonder who's saying blood.
I'm not sure. But yeah, he's like, just stay out of our way. You're not the ones that we have a beef with. So I guess their target is actually the students.
Oh, Blood King was the other Kira, so maybe he's warning Blood then.
Oh, okay. He's calling out warning. Okay,
yeah,
makes sense. Thank you for learning 70,000 character names for us, guys.
Thank you, Crafty Cultist, for reminding us and letting us know how these things work.
So, alright. The villains start to attack, and let's see. Spinner introduces himself. He is the scaly one without a nose and the stain style mask across his eyes. And, he takes off the sword on his back, but it's actually like a whole bunch of swords just strapped together haphazardly with belts and stuff.
It's basically the throne from Game of Thrones. Put into a form, a sword form, where it's just covered in a shit ton of them. And tangential thought, because it wouldn't be what Weekly Manga Recap, but wouldn't be. This actually reminds me of a thing my friend once came up with. He wanted to write a superhero story, and one of his villains was going to have rubber powers, and the way he got it was he was like, the guy would have a way to, like, shoot a power into something, and that would then give him powers of whatever he hit. So he wanted to be covered in blades and shit, so he, like, tied a bunch of knives and shit together with a rubber band and used the power but hit the rubber band instead, so that's all the power he got.
That's a great idea. I like that. What is it? It's Tiger?
Tiger, yeah.
Tiger, after Spinner's introduction, he says, you know, all right, because, you know, Spinner gives this big introduction speech, you're the ones who brought about Stain's Inn in Hosu City. Well, I'm Spinner, and I intend to make my dreams come true. Tiger says, well, that's all well and good, but that woman lying there, Pixie Bob, lately, she's started to worry about getting married, hoping to find some happiness as a woman in this world, and at this age, trying very hard. How dare you scar her face like that and stand there yapping away like it's nothing!
I love it, like, the dramatic turnabout for this fight is they're like, you scar her face and she's already worried about becoming a spinster!
keep in mind, this is a guy with a tiger theme who wears cat claws and hangs out with a magical girl superhero group when he is like a 7-foot-tall muscle freak. So... Oh, God. So, Mandalay instructs Ida to get all of these students away while they hold off the villains, she and Tiger. But Deku says, hang on a second, and stays behind while the other students go ahead, and he says to Mandalay, I know where and that's all he says?
I think he just says, I know where, because she's a telepath, right? So presumably she can read his mind, and he said, like, I know where Kaito is, or Kido, right. Whatever the kid is.
Right. Because so, we, of course, established last time, oh, he's in danger in his super hideaway place. We then cut away to some of the students, not all of them being in, actually, in Class A. We see this one girl from Class B, Kendo, who has enlarged her hands and is... I'm not sure who she's covering with them. I'm not sure if she's trying to protect one of her fellow students. Or
yeah, I think she's using it to protect one of her students, because you see that she doesn't have a gas mask yet. So she's just holding her breath, and I think she's using it to kind of close up the other person so that they don't breathe the right. toxic gas.
But Tetsu comes
Tetsu,
by.
Tetsu!
Right. And he's carrying Ibarra, and they've got gas masks on, and he says, Yairozu was nearby, and she made these gas masks for us. And so we've got a bunch more that we can share, and so on and so forth. So they've planned to head back to camp. Kendo's like, okay, let's get back to safety. And Tetsu says, no, I'm going to fight. You take care of Shiozaki and Kodai. You're always giving Monoma flack, but you feel it too, deep down, right? The difference between us and Class A. I know I feel it anyway. We passed the same test again to UA. We have the same curriculum. But what's the difference? It's obvious. What they've had and we don't. Crisis. They take every crisis and turn it into an opportunity. Heroes shouldn't be running from bad guys like this. Well, he's gonna do something stupid, but...
but it's Tetsu!
He's gonna do it in a badass way, though.
We see, here's the thing that's most interesting to me, is that we've seen all these characters. The one character we haven't really seen in this bit here, at least in a bit, is Shinso. And I feel like that dude's gonna show up in some way in this arc. The... Class B character has the ability to mind control others if he speaks a word to them. Mm. So I feel like that's a guy who could definitely show up here at some point.
Yeah, especially with all those villains bragging about themselves. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, Tetsu says that he is going to actually, you know, beat up the villains, and he says no, you know, not to stay in, and tells them not to stay in his way. Mandalay gets in contact with Kota, and she instructs him, come on, go back to camp. I don't know where you're always running off to. I can't come and get you. You have to get back here. But he is immediately intercepted by one of the villains, who is this large, hulking guy wearing this weird mask. And he just says, he's really weird, because he's like, ah, well, you're not on my list, but you've got a really slick hat, kid.
Apparently there's some gimmick. If you're in the hero-villain group, you have to have a wacky hat.
He says, why don't you train me for this lame mask? See, I'm new to the operation, so they made me wear this stupid thing.
I love that that's literally part of it. They're like, yeah, you can be a part of our villain group, but you have to wear a wacky hat for this to work.
Oh, God. But Kota immediately tries to run away, and so he's like, hey, stop, and he takes off after him and gets in his way while ripping the mask off. And he's like, I'm going to have some fun with you. And while he starts to attack him, we get a flashback, an explanation to... I guess he just saw this on, like, the news or something like that, about his parents in a water hose, and how their lives were cut short by one heartless criminal. The suspect is still on the run, but his quirk is a simple power-up type, making him highly dangerous. If you see this man, call 911 or a hero immediately. At present, his left eye should be scarred from his encounter with water hose. And sure enough, he's got this giant fucking scar with a weird, like, it must be some sort of weird artificial eye or something.
Yeah, it looks like a robot eye.
And, yeah, he's, you know, snarling at Kota as he bears down on him, and immediately Kota starts crying out for his mom and dad. And then Deku arrives on the scene just in the nick of time and snatches Kota out of the way to safety while the guy is bearing down on him. And Deku's got to fight this guy, basically. And he's going to defend Kota while he's doing so. And so he's saying to himself, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I don't have any hope of backup this time. I'm all alone. I've got to deal with this guy alone while protecting Kota. I'm not sure I can do it. But I have to. And so he says, it's gonna be okay, Kota. I'm gonna save you, while his aura crackles around and he gets ready to power up.
I like it, but on one hand, I do have to recognize it's a little bit of a contrivance that Fucking the kid's villain is not only here, but also is the one who encountered him without having any knowledge that this was the kid's parent, like the kid of the parents he killed. But that said, I mean, it's a narrative, it's a story, it's meant to create that. I still like it because this seems like a good opponent for Deku to fight. Somebody whose quirk is simple of just, I also get stronger, and then kind of having to fight there. So I think that's going to be cool, and I think Deku should have a cool fight with him. And it's a heroic thing, too, where he just shows up and he's like, I'm going to put myself in danger to protect this kid. You know, it's
and,
a good...
And also, Deku doesn't know the backstory between Coda and the villain.
Yeah, and that's a cool fucking design. Like, I just love his fucking alien eye. Like, it's so weird. It almost looks like it's, like, an eye behind broken glass, or, like, an eye with, like, teeth around it. Like, I don't understand how an accident would create that, but it looks cool as shit. Now I need to turn my lights on because I'm looking at my screen. It makes it look like I just entered hell. Like I'm just like, no, I went from heaven to hell in one podcast.
Yeah. All right, while he's getting ready, we're going to, I guess I'll just briefly mention Nisekoi. It looks like Nisekoi is kind of back to a little bit of the stuff we had before the important stuff happened, which is, you know, Raju has to do something in order to, you know, well, that focuses on one of his extraneous love interests. It seems like this one might be designed to finally put an end to the whole Haru having a crush on him thing.
I think it's maybe intended to be the notion that this will be when Haru stops falling in love with him and instead supports her sister doing it.
But we've had so many of those that were like supposed to do that, that I'll believe it when I see it. So, and also, Raku is actually, you know, now has a different mindset in this one, which is, you know, he actually specifically wanted to be there to help out at Onodera's place because now he actually is going to be around her while knowing that he's also in love with Shitage, so he wants to try and figure things out. So that's nice. But, you know, not a whole lot to talk about other than that. Let's talk about One Piece.
One Piece!
Something very, very that actually really surprised me happened in One Piece.
This is a very shocking chapter. They said this was the year of Sanji, Nick.
Yeah, yeah. Chapter 812, Capone Gang Beige, which features a really great cover continuing the, you know, side characters reacting to the new wanted posters of the Straw Hats, where we're at the former Arlong Park with... oh, gosh. What is his name? I forget.
Oh, God. Damn it. Hold on, wait.
He's the father figure.
Yeah, he had the windmill in his hat, and I'm trying to remember it.
What?
Genzo?
I don't know.
I think?
Okay. I'm not going
to
correct
Hold
you.
On. I'm not going to look at... I don't want to look at the chat. I don't want to see.
But it's him and...
I'm going to type Genzo into the chat. One Piece.
Well, it's he and...
Yes!
Okay, Genzo then. So he and Nojiko are there at the former Arlong Park, and he is on the Denden Mushi complaining to the government about the shameful image of Nami that they've used for her wanted poster.
That he plasters on the wall?
Just giant picture of her. How dare you use this problematic photo? I do like that. So, last time we found out that Big Mom Pirates, Beige and, Peish, I think is how you say
Peckham?
His name?
Peckham? Peckham? The line Peckham. Guy? Yeah.
That was it.
Peckham.
We're going to check out Zoe, because, you know, that's where he's from. So, he gets there, they get there, they see all the destruction, and immediately he freaks out. He's like, what happened? Who did this to my home? Was it the Straw Hats? What did they do? But then we cut over to, you know, where the Straw Hats are hanging out with all of the Zoe. And apparently, Wanda just... The reason why Wanda was wearing Nami's clothes is just like, the trading of clothes with outsiders is a sign of friendship. And look, we have the same sizes. Who could have predicted this in One Piece, that women would have the same measurements?
It's like we have the exact same body shape and almost face. If I didn't have a dog snap, we might look identical.
Oh, God. Meanwhile, Sanji is going around like, "Oh, look, got you! Yes, yes, intimacy with all the hot females." Yeah, yeah. And all the like male animals are like, "We'll do it with you too." No,
get away!
I'm a furry now, but I'm not gay. But you know, just kind of like catching up with how they've been spending their time, essentially. But then eventually, Peckums shows up. And he's relieved, and he's crying, and he's embracing all these old friends. And he's, "Oh, Daddy, Mommy, my friends, my family. I was so upset when I saw the city and the destruction, but I'm so happy that you're alive." And he's just, you know, down on his hands and knees. He's like, "I can't believe this happened. Oh, Jack of the Animal Kingdom pirates, how dare you do this?" And so on and so forth. And the Straw Hats are freaking out, well, that, you know, someone from the Big Mom Pirates is there. But eventually they're just, because they're, you know, debating what they're going to do, because, you know, they're after Caesar Clown and so on and so forth, and Caesar Clown doesn't want to be handed over to them, because they think, maybe if we just give them Caesar Clown, they'll leave us alone. Caesar Clown's like, actually, I was given money so I could do research, but I wasn't actually, you know, getting anywhere, so I just pocketed the money instead, so... Maybe you shouldn't, like, turn me over at all. Well, we don't really care about that. Come on! let's see. But eventually, Sanji decides that they're going to meet with Peckums and Beige, and so he goes off with Brooke to meet with them. And Sanji's like, "All right, what do you guys want?" And Peckums says, "The only thing I can say... thank you!" He just gets down on his hands and knees, and he's like, "I had no idea that this was happening here. You are my saviors. How can I ever thank you?" And he explains, "Yes, you know, Big Mama's orders were to capture Caesar, but there's a new order that's bound to spell disaster for the Straw Hats. So that settles it. The mission's a failure. Just give us Caesar, and I'll explain it to Mama that we let the Straw Hats escape." And Beige is like, "What are you talking
about?
What
the fuck, Peckums?!
What are you doing?" Apparently they didn't talk.
Well, actually, I guess Peckham should be like, "Nah, she, Peckham, she lost her mind. Never make that business personal, she."
Yeah. And Peckham's like, "Look, I'll just take the fall for this. You know, just let me do this. I can't do this. These people saved my family and friends. I cannot take them in and turn them over to Big Mama like this."
"Ah, you clown!"
And yeah, Beige just shoots him in the back, basically. But... you know, the opening of this chapter where Peckham's just like, "No, they saved my home. I'm not going to do this." I really like this development. I love when you have, you know, a villainous character who has depth to them in some way. And he has priorities that, you know, go against him working for the evil captain. Or
yeah, Big Mom, who we just see as like a stereotypical villain. She forces places to just make her candy. That's all we know about her, really. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool seeing one of her subordinates like have more to it than that.
And then we find out immediately that Beige has this really weird and really cool ability because
this he is actually pull something out we've known. This is we found this out a while ago. We never understood the mechanics of how this worked, but for the first time we saw him, or when they revealed everyone's powers during like when Kizaru attacked, we saw little people inside of him in some fashion.
Right. So we see that there are these other gangsters in pinstripe suits inside his hand who have shot Gatling guns through his palm at Peckham's, and then it's so weird because, you know, he then lowers a drawbridge out of his chest and a whole lot more guys come out, and then they suddenly grow and surround Sanji and Brooke, and Beige explains that he has eaten the castle fruit, and he is captain of the Fire Tank Pirates Capone Gang Beige with a bounty of 300 million.
It was always a cool power. It was a cool power, too, when we first saw it, and now seeing, like, exactly what I guess it's supposed to do, like, as I'm a castle man, it's a very innovative power I like.
His body is a fortress, and...
He keeps his crew inside of it, literally.
Right. And not only can he do that, we also... but it's like, he can do other things with his body as well, that we find out. So... But, yeah, so... Brooke is, you know, Brooke and Sanji are like, "Oh, well, this is really weird, but, Beige says, "Okay, look, you know, I could have destroyed him with cannons, but we're going to keep this quiet because that's in our best interests. And, you know, because we don't want the Mings to get involved with this." And it turns out that Chopper and Nami have already been captured by one of his men somehow. I don't know exactly how that happened, but good job, guys.
They said they were curious, so they went to go see and presumably just guard grabbed them.
Sneak attacked them or something.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where he calls out to Caesar and he's like, "You better get down here because my men are gonna shoot sea prism stone shotgun skyward." And Caesar Clench immediately appears and he's like, no, don't shoot me! Ah, all right, good, you're here. Also, we didn't have sea prism stone bullets in those guns. Wait, what?
Although he does know
one spear made of the stuff,
which seems like something that'll have to come in later and play some part.
Right. So then Beige basically forces them into his castle and just like imprisons them inside his body, and then they, you know, they have like, you know, like let's sit down to dinner kind of thing in order to discuss what we want from you type of scenes, but it's actually inside of him.
And it's weird because I guess he could just pop up himself as a figure inside his own body.
Like a miniature version materializes in front of Sanji to speak with him. And Sanji's actually the only one sitting at the table. All the others are just in chains behind him. And, you know, he's trying, Beige at first is trying to be a little bit, cordial and so on and so forth. But eventually Sanji is just like, come on, let's just get this over with. And so he's like, all right, I've got an invitation to you for Mama's tea party. The main event this time is a wedding. The groom is Sanji, third son of the Vinsmoke family. The bride, Pudding, 35th daughter of the Charlotte family.
Dun, 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 dun. Sanji's actually a prince, literally.
Yeah.
This is huge.
It is a big revelation. And this, of course, I'm sure must play some part into where the hell Sanji went, and seems to imply that maybe they're, I guess inevitably, one of the upcoming arcs of One Piece is going to have to be dealing with getting Sanji back, or Sanji's escape, or something involving his forced marriage into Big Mom's family, I guess.
It's interesting, because we know there are some characters in the Straw Hats, and this is a complaint One Piece gets very frequently, that characters don't grow. That characters really don't have development. They, you know, they join the crew and they are who they are throughout the entire thing. But this is a legitimate moment of character growth, and we've gotten it a couple of times, and they're usually very good. I mean, you could say most of Water 7 is, I think, one of the best parts of the series, because that's where Usopp grows and that's where Robin grows. You know, she makes the things, I want to live. I don't want to just die because of who I am. And that was a cool thing. And maybe that's what they're setting up for here. But more than anything, it's just really interesting that Sanji is a prince, because we've known very little about him, but we've had instincts to suggest there's something more. Like, he was the only one born in the North Blue. He's the only one from the North Blue in all of the Straw Hats. Mm-hmm. How is he, if he was a prince, how did he become a chef aboard a ship? The one that eventually became the one that, you know, got attacked in the storm and he, you know, got stranded with Zeff back in the day. Like, how did he reach that point more than anything is what I'm now kind of curious about. Now it kind of explains why he's wanted alive on his poster. It kind of explains maybe why he calls himself Mr. Prince, maybe why he's so smart and all these things. But there's little details I really still want to know about, and it's just a really intriguing way to introduce this, and it definitely builds upon the idea that this is going to be the year of Sanji, because this is a huge deal. And I'm really kind of excited about that.
Yeah.
So I think it's very cool. I would love it if it is something like he's going to marry this Pudding girl because he wants to kind of keep Big Mom from going after the Straw Hats or something like that, and then maybe it reaches the point where they have to go and rescue him and it becomes like a rescue Sanji arc or something like that. I think it's going to be very exciting in that regard, and I'm very, very excited for how this is going to go, because I think it's an awesome chapter. And it's
I would love it if Pudding were a super hot girl and Sanji was totally not into her. How great would that be?
I feel like that's what they have to play for, because it's too easy to go with the joke that she's some hideous monster, but if she's super hot and he's just like, oh, I don't like it.
Because, you know, I'm being forced into this and you're my enemy and so on and so forth, yeah.
That'd be very funny. And it's clearly the chapter of the week. I kept this pull up since Wednesday, so this is the accumulation of like 4 days worth of people's opinions, and One Piece has far and away won over the track record on that. What if it's Bonnery? That's an interesting theory. We do know Bonnery is someone important too.
What, the
Jewelry Bonnery, the one with the who has the age shrinking power, who eats a lot.
Yeah, she's got a food gimmick,
and she also has some sort of big family, because we remember Blackbeard and Kizaru had something to say right. about that, or Akane rather had something to say about that. Yeah, so possibly. I don't know if she's. I always assumed it was maybe something related more to like a celestial dragon, but it's actually an interesting theory.
Oh, I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes, though.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. And I think Capone, more than anything, really showed off how awesome he was at this chapter.
Yeah. Let's move on to Toriko, Gourmet 354, The Footfall of the Wolf King. Guinness stomped. That's what happened.
This is a legitimately, I think, a cool chapter, though.
It's cool because it's just a fight scene.
It's cool also because
it's not incredibly eventful. You know, Star June and Toriko show up. They combine attacks in a really cool way into like this fire sword whip thing that happens. And in order to fight off this one of the weird beasts that has got launched all around the world. And but then Guinness just stomps. And Star June and Toriko are like, well, this is bad. And they dodge out of the way. And it's described that Toriko sends knives through his feet,
giant
miles into the earth in order to stop himself from being blown backwards. And Star June also does something similar. But even so, they're knocked hundreds of miles away by the shockwave of the wolf stomping.
But that's what I love when Toriko's ridiculous and silly like that.
And then
so,
it pisses.
It's so goofy you can't help but laugh.
This is definitely one of the better chapters of Toriko we've gotten in the last few weeks, because that whole thing with the flashback was just stupid. And this was the good kind of stupid.
Yeah. This is the stupid I completely get behind, where you're like, oh yeah, no, Toriko could just stretch giant knives and forks through the ground to slow his his speed so he doesn't get knocked away when the battle wolf stomped. It's goofy, but I like that kind of goofy. So to that regard, this was probably my favorite Toriko chapter in, like, the past few months.
And their souls are being sucked out for some reason, which I guess we'll get into more detail next time. So.
Yeah. I love it when I... Because now I time code episodes, so if you can just click and go. And Toriko's always like, oh, it started 1:53:09, and it ended at 1:55... it's always within like 2 minutes.
It was just a very short chapter, not a lot. That does not mean that it was a bad chapter. It was actually a pretty good chapter overall. It's just that, well, bad happened.
Yeah, no, I liked it a lot.
It's the joke. It's the joke that we would make about Bleach all the time. So, all right. So yeah, let's finish up with World Trigger. Which is on chapter... God, where is that chapter title? I hate when I can't find the chapter
title. I feel like this... It's second page. 127.
127, Galapala, Part 6. Yotaro and Raijin Maru are off to try and find Hyusei, as we saw at the end of the last chapter. And Yotaro is trying to be like, okay, you know, Raijin Maru, you know, Hyusei had curry for lunch, so, you know, try and find that. Sniff out his curry farts.
Yeah, it's probably what he's doing. I assume that's what a capybara does naturally. Like, it's like, oh, someone else is farting? Let me follow where that's coming. I have so many fart sound effects on my computer from that scene.
So, Jin now knows about this, and he just thinks, of, God damn it, why are with kids going for the lowest probability futures for no reason? So he's just kind of analyzing the possibilities, and he's like, see, if the away ship is destroyed, Fort Ship, Aizen's chances are going to drift further away of being able to find Yuma, but this one, I actually have to go to myself in order to handle it. So I leave the away ship in your hands, our top attackers. So, interesting, I guess. I guess in the end, maybe Hyusei actually will do something very good for Aftokrator. So we get some more of the fight between Border's agents and the Galapolo squadron. A lot of the gunners using their various different bullet techniques to take down the more humanoid neighbor androids until they actually start to fall back. And then, oh god, what is his name? You know his name.
What?
Spiffy dressed guy.
Oh, Ninomiya.
Yeah, Nina Mia.
Big awesome Nina Mia with his big smart brain that Annalisa isn't here to yell at us at.
Right, yeah. I do remember, I think, you saying, like, oh, look at Nina Mia, you know, being a team player.
Being so smart.
And she would be like,
She basically is exactly Kako in this chapter, where she's just like, oh, you're going to do it? He's like, is there a problem? She's like, no, but I don't like it. Yes, you're talented and you completely have all the qualifications for the role, but fuck you.
So, yeah, he's just like, okay, you know, we'll use the snipers in order to snipe the retreating ones. We gotta get rid of as many of them while we can, so let's send half the snipers after them and pursue them on the ground. And then Kako just kind of goes, oh, you're taking command then. And he's like, yeah, is there a problem with that? No. But I don't like it. That is a good line. I like that.
I do like his logic, too. He's like, look, you know, not for nothing. I'm one of the smartest guys here. I'm a natural leader. I'm gonna come in and take the lead. And then, I think it's Arashiyawa's like, or no, it's, one of Suba Squad members are like, leaders are normally in order of age of rank. And then Arashiyama's like, well, then Suba should take charge. And he does. And it's like how Nina Mia's like, this is what always happens.
Kaka's like, but it doesn't feel as annoying as before. Also, I like how someone from, I forget their names, but Nina Mia's white-haired underling.
And yeah.
No girl in Kako's squad, they're like, our captain's sure getting along well. Yeah, and he's like fiddling with her pigtail.
I remember, it's such a weird thing. He's like fluffing, he's like shaking her pigtail. He's like, flop, 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 flop. And she has no response. She's like, yep. And you can see Katora's looking at him, and it's just like, what?
Aren't you going to say nice things about me, guys?
Oh my god, Nick. I might have crazy good news for everybody. Well, bro. When I say everybody, I mean me. I don't have work tomorrow. They closed the state down. Guess who's sleeping in tomorrow?
Guess who's not driving through the snow? Oh, you got some moves, huh?
Just continue with Rope Trigger. I'll be dancing for the next 5 minutes.
So they go to pursue after the robotic neighbors and stuff. There's a few different things exchanged between the various agents as they get ready to do that. And Nemea's like, okay, you know, we gotta make sure not to spread out too thin and so on and so forth. And Sua's like, all right, let's, you know, mow them down until we reach Miwa Nunea. And Galapala's operator is like, okay, the snipers are moving. We're gonna, you know, we're outnumbering them. We just gotta use the billions and surround them. And someone tells him to send in more dogs. And we actually see his controls, which are like two. Like a game controller with two track balls on it.
It looks like it was in a competition to see who could make a more inconvenient controller between this and the N64 controller. Like, which one is more awkward to hold and use? And this one just slightly beats out the N64 controller.
No one used the D-pad. What were they even thinking?
Why bother? Why bother?
Just chop off the entire third. God. Then the operator, I guess it's a different operator. I think they might have two. Yeah. The other one kind of, like, takes control of one of the, robotic neighbors and shifts it to manual mode. Or I guess he's actually taking control of two of them, because two of them glow. And then we cut inside to where the leader is, and, yes, the top attackers are all there. Tachikawa and Konami, and I forget his name.
Ko Murakami, I think. Okay. And Tachikawa. And Kazama's there secretly.
Right. Shh. So, the two Galapala neighbors, the totally not father and son, the totally not son activates his trigger, which is like this weird backpack thing that's then starts to dispense portals to summon more of the robots. And Tachikawa, they're like, okay, we've got multiple Tryon rings in this room, so beware of traps. And Tachikawa says, Mr. Kanuda has fortified the walls and the valuable stuff's been put away. So sound isn't an issue because we're underground, and unlike the surface, meteors are a free-for-all. So we can just, you know, do whatever the hell we want in order to fight you. So, yeah, basically they're just saying, you know, we're not gonna, you know, hold back when we're taking you on. See, we're not gonna even bother trying to keep this a secret, essentially. So the Gapel guys are trying to analyze what they're going to do, and Tachikawa's mocking them by saying, you know, what you're after is inside here behind me. And they're like, what? Well, if you want to destroy the away ship, you're going to have to beat us first. And they're like, wait, why do they...
What's going on? Not only do they know what we're after, they have information on our triggers.
And when he is distracted, suddenly Kazama comes up from behind him and decloaks while cutting his arm off.
Yoink. Actually, the sound effect is sliced, but I feel like it should be yoink.
And Tachikawa's like, oops, sorry. That's four of us. So, unblinking Christopher Walken then just summons Dr. Octopus arms, basically. They're not, like, tentacles exactly, but they're, you know, these kind of, like, spider sharp limbs and stuff. And then also he takes something from a pack behind him and applies it to his arm wound to then turn it into a gun. Mega Man style, essentially. And, yeah, so, like, well, okay, I guess that attack didn't do very much to him. Uh-oh. So, yeah, this guy does look kind of badass. I do think the Tachikawa might die, I guess. It's like, oh no, my arm's gonna cut off. It turned into a gun.
Yeah, so now I'm Samus with Dr. Octopus.
So, they're getting ready to square off, all six of them, and that's where the chapter ends.
It is very exciting, and this dude does look like a badass, so I'm kind of excited to see what he gets to do here.
I'm looking forward to the fight. Not an incredibly good chapter, but we did get some fun exchanges between some of the characters that I liked. So, yeah, looking forward to what happens next week.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely a lot of, I look forward to seeing where this goes next week. You know, a good feeling of anticipation in a lot of chapters.
Absolutely.
So, that said, I guess let's do our best of this week.
The best of the best.
Yeah.
Our weekly best dressed of Jump. I pick Hitsugaya, obviously. Nick, you pick.
Oh, no, Hitsugaya, you know, you know, the way he looked on the runway, yeah, he doesn't want enough, no.
he's not Cheshire. Well, let me work some America's Next Top Model into this. He's not smiling with his eyes enough. Smize.
I did not find out about that until, like, a month ago. The whole, like, secret to Tyra Banks' success model is smizing.
Smizing.
And there's a video where she explains the difference between looking and just and smiling.
She's like, this is you. You need to be doing this.
No, she doesn't even do that. She does this. This is me looking. This is me staring. And this is me smizing.
Yeah, she just...
You lowered, like, your head!
She just, like, shifts herself a little bit. Like, this is smiling with my eyes.
That's just lowering the... Yes, you're changing the perspective of how your eyes look when... Yes, everyone knows that. So, my series of the week is going to be One Piece. Really liked basically every element of the chapter. And also my weekly MVP is going to be Peckoms, because I was very taken aback by the actions that he took and the characterization that he got before he was shot.
Well, my weekly MVP is going to go to Capone for shooting him and also just looking very cool. I thought he was supremely awesome this week. I like getting to get a follow-up to when we first got teased to what his powers are, and to see him as, like, this lieutenant in one of the biggest armies on the planet now, I think is going to be supremely awesome. That said, my chapter of the week goes to Black Clover. I think Black Clover had a strong, solid, individual chapter this week that feels like a conclusion. I don't think Black Clover is going to be getting any more chapters of the week from us for a little bit, because I imagine we're going to be building up to something else from here. But I feel like this chapter was really cool, and I love the way it all kind of played out.
I did definitely consider Black Clover, because it was very good. Also, Gauch was a strong contender for my
MVP,
because that character development that he got this week was really good, but I like Peckham's just a little bit more.
And One Piece was really a hard consideration for me as well. And I honestly considered giving it to Toriko as well. I thought Toriko just...
Because it was actually good this week.
Just for the fact that it had a good week, I was like, holy shit, I almost have to kind of give it to that. But
I'm never going
to
get this chance again.
It was really hard. I feel like every chapter this week really kind of sold me on a chance of taking it, but I gave it to Black Clover.
All right, with that said, I guess that is going to do it. Stick around so that you guys know what we're going to be covering next time. Or not next time, necessarily, but, you know, what suggestion we're taking next. Thank you guys for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. Normally we do the show on hitbox.tv/realty Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We had to change things because I fell asleep. This week, I'll not do that because it's inconvenient for everybody.
Although I feel like our European fans are actually very thankful for this, because it's the first chance they've had to see Weekly Manga Recap live in, like, years.
Because we're doing it in the afternoon as opposed to, like, starting at midnight.
For yeah, them. Normally we'd be like, in an hour from now we'll start-ish.
Be sure to check out our past episodes. You can check them out on our YouTube account and also weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, subscribe to the YouTube account, and also, speaking of iTunes, make sure to leave a comment and a rating so that we can beat those woodworkers.
Yes. Someone needs to help us do that, because we weren't one of iTunes' 2015 best voted podcasts, unfortunately. It went to other people, like the Flophouse and other talented podcasts that we aren't considered amongst the pantheon of on quite yet. It's because people aren't giving us 5-star reviews. How else can we get there?
Special thanks go out.
I am secretly, I'm doing my part. I'm searching every sandpit I find for a genie, but I'm not sure if that's going to pay dividends, so you guys have to do your part too.
You can also send criticism and ask questions and make suggestions for future manga for us to read. Send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters, because your support allows us to do all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. Like the bonus podcast that we'll be recording soon, doing Q&A podcasts and stuff like that.
Yes, you will get the new Q&A, or not the new Q&A, but the new, for patrons, you'll get, champion patrons, you'll get the weekly manga recap lives this week.
Special thanks also go to Steve Mann, our top artist. You can check out his work at NewRockFanboy.DeviantArt.com, iDrewBoobs.Tumblr.com, Patreon.com/SteveMann, and some other websites, which I never wrote down. But he's at more than those three locations. I know that for a fact.
If you check him out, and you shoot him a message, I'm sure he'll be happy to send you to anywhere else.
He'll send you his, like, his book of the web addresses you can find him at.
Great work for him. I love the title card he did this week for Phantom Blood. I think it looks awesome, so great guy.
And also, special thanks go out to Infamous Planet for all the awesome work that he does.
He's not here. You can insult the shit out of him this week.
Oh, he's not here?
Ironically, the week it's more convenient for a British time zone is the week he didn't show up.
He keeps weird hours, I guess. But, yeah, he really helps us out with a lot of stuff. He helped make the stream frame and, of course, started off doing visual editions of our show before we switched over to YouTube and stuff.
And he just put up the one, coincidentally, we were talking about JoJo this week, he just put up the one that is the first episode that we ever talked about JoJo on, which was when it was me joined by Drew Wario. He did a visual edition for that, so it's an over 2-hour visual edition of JoJo that if you haven't seen it before, and if you're a huge JoJo fan, I highly recommend you check out, again, once you can find it on youtube.com/infamousplanet.
From an era in which 2-hour weekly manga recaps were actually strong.
That was an anomaly. At the time, we were like, 53 minutes, that's enough time for the podcast. Now it's like, did we get to Fairy Tail in that amount of time?
All right. Now,
Real quick, I want to give a shout out to Justin Baltelt, who is our newest patron. So thank you very much, Justin. Your support is greatly appreciated.
Now, so when we covered the annual manga recap, I said, yeah, we didn't actually have too many horrible manga to actually do our worst of from.
No.
I specifically said, you guys need to send in more bad suggestions. Someone did send in a deliberately bad suggestion, but I looked into it. It's only 5 chapters long. I think we need a little bit more to discuss than that. Even if it does deal with a 10-year-old having sex. No, we need
what?
More. It's just not long enough.
Is that going to be our February theme? Pedophilia.
So instead, I dug back into our archives for people who had made suggestions for bad manga before, and I found one that I think will definitely do well enough, and it will actually be considerably longer than that one, and give us probably way more content than we'll need to have a good long discussion about it. It is a classically bad series in the vein of all of your favorite weekly manga recap suggestions that we hated, which dealt with incest, because this is Aki Sora, which is about brother-sister incest, from what I understand.
Oh, no.
So, look forward to that, everybody!
Oh, God! What have you brought, Nick?
We're doing JoJo, we're doing Pokemon this year, we're gonna have plenty of good series!
Nick, you spoiled! We haven't told anybody this is Pokemon year as well!
Get my neuralizer out now.